move and communicate. It's like an army instruction.
I think we both have to do this.
Mark, you know?
Mark, I think we both have to do this.
Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue interim is open.
And the House Committee on Revenue is open for business for this morning, December 2nd, 2015. Paul, you want to start?
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just point out kind of a business issue. Because this isn't legislative days, you need to be sure and fill out your per diem form and give those to Corinne. Okay, and we'll take it from there.
Thank you. And with that, we'll go ahead with the main order of the day. Gentlemen.
Hi, Chair Barnhart, Senator Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Mark McMullen, Office of Economic Analysis, joined as always by my colleague Josh Lehner. So, once again, it's time for the quarterly economic and revenue forecast update. In terms of recent performance, Oregon's economy is still going at full throttle. Our job gains are matching the fastest we saw during the housing boom. And in terms of our tax revenues, they're booming as well. Our three largest sources of state tax revenue, the personal income tax, corporate income tax, and lottery distributions are all growing at double-digit rates right now. And so this is just about as good as it gets. Oregon's traditional economic advantage has really come back in terms of job growth vis-a-vis other states. The first chart that we have here, we've shown you before, indicates that, you know, whenever the U.S. is expanding, or at least since World War II, Oregon's jobs have grown at a faster rate. We outperform in every single expansion. Our problem, as always, is that we outperform in the contractions as well, and that we lose more jobs during recessions than does the typical state. But we're there again now, where we have a full percentage point growth advantage over the U.S. average. And it's for the same reasons that it typically has been in the past, mainly two. One is we're still a place that makes a lot of things. We're still connected to manufacturing and resource industries. Those industries are traditionally very pro-cyclical, meaning they boom and bust along with the overall economy, and they have large swings. And so this puts larger swings into our underlying economy. And that's important right now because in terms of the overall macroeconomic outlook, most analysts are still pretty bullish about the near term. At least, you know, at the U.S. level, most analysts are not afraid yet, despite the fact that we've been in this expansion for many years. Most aren't really worried about a near-term recession. As always, there are a couple of Chicken Littles out there, but for the most part, the consensus is pretty healthy right now. But the one place where we are starting to see some fault lines in the economy is in manufacturing and in the pipeline of manufacturing. And Josh is going to talk a little bit about that more. But since it's so important to us in particular, the fact that we're starting to see some indicators that the manufacturing cycle is ending is of course, a concern. And the other reason we have our traditional growth advantage is because of population gains. In particular, whenever we have available jobs, we get an influx of workers, and skilled young households in particular. And by all accounts, this has come back in droves. We're seeing growth, population growth, really across the state pick up. And we've got the newest numbers in right now that we'll talk about a little bit more later as well. So in terms of job growth, we're still doing well. We have come off a bit from the end of 2014, beginning of 2015, which, you know, it's a little softer than our forecast for jobs. Our advisory groups in May, when we set the close of session forecast, were very, very optimistic about keeping this full throttle going for another year or two. It looks like that may come off a little bit, but in terms of tracking and the personal income tax, we're still right on the money because wages are coming in a little stronger than we expected. Although job growth is a little weaker, wage growth is a little bit stronger. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that, because that's a better indicator that we're getting close to a real healthy job market.
Thanks, Mark. For the record, Josh Lanner, Office of Economic Analysis. And as Mark said, one of the things we're seeing in Oregon, we have been for the last year or two, is stronger wage gains. Nationally, the average worker in the U.S. has not seen an inflation-adjusted wage increase since the Great Recession, right? Wages have increased at the U.S. around 2% a year. Inflation's around 2% a year, a little bit lower. Here in Oregon, that's not the case. What you see in front of you is withholding. This is one of our major tax revenue sources for the state. It comes out of everyone's paycheck, of course. And so what you see here is the mix between hours worked, number of jobs increasing, and average pay increases at the same time. If you do the math on some of the other different wage measures, the typical worker in Oregon or the average worker in Oregon is increasing, they're getting their wage increases of 3 to 4% a year. At the U.S., it's more like 2%, and just now in the last couple months has ticked up to 2.5% at the national level, right? In Oregon, again, we're at 3 to 4%, depending upon which measures you're looking at. So we've seen significant wage increases for Oregon workers, particularly relative to the nation and the typical state. Our incomes are still lower. Our per capita personal income, our average wages, they're all still lower than that in the typical state in the U.S. However, we're making some progress in recent years because we're seeing this stronger, deeper labor market recovery in the aftermath of the Great Recession. And you can see here withholdings growing a little bit faster than what we saw a decade ago during the housing boom, but still is a little notch below what we saw in the 1990s when we had the full-on economic boom, the last time the U.S. economy truly was at full employment. With that being said, cumulatively, the Oregon economy has made a lot of progress in the last 5 years. Sure, it's been a little slow and lackluster, particularly back in the dark days, 2010, 11, 12. But overall, progress is being made. The jobs in the state of Oregon have never been higher. Unfortunately, but the population has also never been higher. And so we have 50,000 more jobs today in Oregon than we did prior to the Great Recession, but we also have more people. And so we're still about a year out from when the number of jobs catches back up with the number of, say, working age population folks within the state. And what you see here, and with the return of migration flows, as Mark was talking about, it takes some time to absorb these new workers into the labor market, right? People show up here without a job, and they're looking for work. And over the long term, Oregon's economy has been able to absorb most of these migrants, these new workers, into our labor force, but it takes some time, right? People show up, and there's not always a job immediately available. It's one of the reasons why our unemployment rate tends to be typically higher, because a lot of these are the skilled young households with not a lot of experience. They move here in their 20s and 30s looking for work. But again, this gap is closing. Right now we're gaining about 4,000 jobs a month in the state of Oregon, but we only need about 2,000 jobs a month to keep up with population growth. So we're closing this gap pretty quickly, and over the course of the next year or so, we're expecting the jobs to catch back up with the underlying population growth. And at that point forward, we're expecting growth rates to slow considerably, right? Right now we're still getting some of the cyclical boost coming out of the recession. We're still getting some of the catch-up growth that we need to make the economy back to where we were a decade ago. But once we hit that full employment level, we're going to slow down to some sort of sustainable growth rate moving forward.
Perhaps the most encouraging thing about our expansion, and we've mentioned this quite a bit before and over the past year, is that it's spread outside of our metropolitan areas to a lot of our rural areas, which is very encouraging given how hard they were hit during the recession. We've grouped all the non-metropolitan area counties into five different regions, and among these groups, that every single region of the state is rural region of the state is adding jobs, and everyone is adding jobs somewhere around this 2% rate, which is as fast as the U.S. average. So this is particularly encouraging. Now, not every county is adding jobs. You have to smash them together. That would be too much to ask that all of our counties would be growing at the same time. But nevertheless, when we look at these broader regions, we are. Now, of course, you see the downturns were much larger than the upswing so far. For the typical rural county, we're looking at being only about 25 or 50% back to where they were before the recession. But nevertheless, there are gains, and even more encouraging, I think, than jobs are population gains. This last month, we got new population, county-level population numbers released, and it appears that population growth has picked up across the state, too, in most of our rural areas. There was a concern because, as in Portland as well, we saw, you know, population growth really slow during the housing bust, and the concern was to what extent will this come back as the economy does, and it looks like for most places that is the case across the state. Most of our counties have the same sort of pattern as Portland. They don't grow as fast, but there was a really drop in migration during the housing bust, and it appears to be back to about the housing boom levels today. Now, the biggest exception to this would be in Representative Bence's neighborhood, where we haven't really seen an increase again in population growth, but yet those areas didn't really lose a lot during the housing bust either. More flat trends there, with being driven by international migration rather than domestic migration, and losing some population to outflows to Idaho. But other than some of the most eastern counties, it really does look like things are swinging around. So, in general, everything is pretty hunky-dory right now, but we are starting to see a couple of risks emerge, in particular to these our comparative advantages that we mentioned, the reason why we grow faster in expansions, because of our exposure to manufacturing and good producers and to migration trends. Well, both of these things are starting to look like there may be some risks in the near term. So I'm going to pass it over to Josh to discuss those a little bit deeper.
In terms of manufacturing, we've seen a pullback at the national level, right? The pullback from mostly related to the oil and gas industry with the collapse of oil prices. North Dakota and Texas are hurting. It's hit the pipeline of metal makers across the board. But so far, it hasn't washed ashore here in Oregon. And the global economic weakness at the same time with the strong U.S. dollar, it's a recipe for disaster for the manufacturing sector, particularly our exporting good industries. However, we haven't seen it here. If you look up until the forecast line, manufacturing job growth in the state of Oregon is running around 4%, which is as fast as manufacturing growth has done in at least a generation or so. It's about as fast as it goes. But we're expecting that to come off pretty sharply here in the near term due to all these other events. Again, the national economy for the pipeline of orders is looking relatively weak, if not really weak. Canada's in recession. China's having a really big slowdown. Japan and Korea aren't doing particularly well either. A lot of our major trading partners are slowing down. We just saw our first big announcement in terms of the manufacturing industry in Portland. ESCO Corporation is shutting down their operations. In Northwest Portland, a couple hundred jobs are going to be lost. That's our first real significant layoff announcement we've seen. Typically, manufacturing is sort of a canary in the coal mine where in terms of the overall business cycle. And so when you start to see the manufacturers announce layoffs, that usually is a bad sign in terms of where the business cycle is heading. The one thing that is offsetting this is our high-tech industry. The tech industry, the PC market, the semiconductors is also waning right now, but so far it's been a mild slowdown. If you look at the pipeline of semiconductor orders, or if you look at the equipment for the new machines that go into new facilities that build semiconductors or produce semiconductors, it actually has held up relatively strong. It's flattened out, it's slowed down, but it hasn't been a massive correction or a massive downswing like you typically see historically. And so along those lines, we haven't seen a lot of layoffs in our high tech industry. There's been a few with our largest employer in the state in Portland announcing some layoffs over the summer. However, we're also getting some positive news out of Representative Barnhart's district with Avago going into the old Hynex facility in Eugene. It's going to take some time to retrofit the building and to add some jobs, but it's going to be at least a couple hundred, if not north of 500 or 600 jobs, depending upon how the process goes and how long the business cycle lasts and all that sort of thing. But it's good news, right? So we're getting some good news out of an industry that's also sort of slowing down and waning in the near term. And so manufacturing, again, is a risk to the outlook. You can see in front of you, we have job growth basically evaporating tomorrow. We're not having a lot of outright job losses, but we're seeing a significant slowdown just due to the combination of the weak global economy, the strong U.S. dollar that makes exporting more expensive to foreign consumers, and it makes importing cheaper for U.S. consumers at the same time. It's a risk to look moving forward, and it could be worse than this, but this is our baseline forecast right now.
I would note that the manufacturing plant you're describing is actually in Representative Holvey's district.
Oh.
But I do expect a number of the of the people who will work there will live in other parts of the Eugene-Springfield area, and some of them will live in my district. So it is really good news. The other news you didn't mention, which happened yesterday, is the return of RV manufacturing in Junction City. Also not my district, but again, workers live all around the area.
Thank you, Representative. I do not know all the political boundaries by heart, but it's within your region. Well,
in my area, I do know them.
Yeah. Yes, understood.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. This is something within your district. Another risk to the outlook is housing affordability, particularly among our fast-growing, generally metropolitan areas of the state. Bend, Hood River, Portland are having rapidly eroding housing affordability. It's causing a lot of price pressure, household finance issues for people up and down the income spectrum. This is not just a low-income household issue. It's reaching up into the upper middle class even in terms of housing affordability. And so we've seen a big increase in calls for affordable housing. One of the things that's interesting is that most low-income households and moderate-income households don't live in subsidized housing. They live in market-rate housing, things that just happen to be less expensive than new construction, because new construction is expensive. It's built for the upper middle class and the upper class themselves. However, over time, it becomes less expensive as tastes change, different neighborhoods turn over, different ones become trendy. You have aging of housing if it doesn't get remodeled every time. Generally, older homes are more affordable homes, and that's where you see a lot of the bulk of the population living in affordable housing live in these older homes. And what you see here is median home value over time over the last 100 years for both Representative Barnhart's district and Representative Bent's district. Here, 60 is Bent's and 11 is Barnhart, if I did my numbers correctly. And the typical pattern you would generally see across the nation in a lot of areas looks a lot like Representative Bent's district, where the newer homes are the most expensive, and then you see this filtering over time where the older homes are less expensive. However, in some of our larger population centers that have some geographic supply constraints to housing, they have some land use restrictions and political constraints at the same time, we see an inverted or sort of a U-shaped pattern where the new construction is expensive, but the 100-year-old homes are also expensive. Again, some of that has to do with downtown revitalization, becoming hip and cool, close in Portland neighborhoods are along the same lines. These are the two different patterns of the housing market you generally see in terms across the country. So in a normal functioning market, you would see something a little bit closer to Representative Bent's district, where there's enough ample supply of housing. And so as the stock filters over time, you get more and more housing, affordable housing for the moderate income folks. That is not always the case, and particularly with the Great Recession, with the lack of new supply coming on the market. Everything we're building today is at the high end of the market, luxury apartments, luxury infill developments, things like that. And while that does nothing for housing affordability today for the people at the lower income households, over time it will, right? The derogatory term in San Francisco, they call this trickle-down housing policy, and they say it doesn't work. Well, it doesn't work immediately, but supplying the high-end need first, the people that can afford the new construction, over time it really does help the housing market. And so that's one of the reasons why we need to make sure we have an ample supply of housing continuing to be built with our population gains, which are continuing to increase, as Mark has talked about, because over time it does result in more affordable housing for a wider sector of the population.
So risks aside, the general character of our economic outlook is full throttle growth for another year or so until we reach this full employment somewhere around there where we're done with the catch-up phase of the business cycle. And at that point, we settle into lower rates of long-term trend growth. Now, over the next year, this is really what we're going to be watching is the economic outlook. Well, typically, we look at both, you know, how the revenues are coming in as well as, you know, how the economy is matching our expectations. But given that we just turned on the new IT processing system for Department of Revenue for personal income taxes and the other major programs, we are not going to really have data that's going to be comparable to the past for some time. They turned the lights out on us in October, and so by the time we come up here for the February session, we'll have 1 month of data under the new system, and it'll be at least a year before we can try to compare that to December from the last few years, because we don't know, you know, coding are different and processing speeds are different, so it'll be hard to make these comparisons across time. So as we head into this first year and a half of the biennium here, we're going to really, the the revenue forecast is really going to reflect how we're doing here on the economic outlook. So far, but in general, how to read this chart? We put this one up quite a bit. These are the evolution of our quarterly forecast. So each of these gray bars is one of the times we come up here and present to this group, starting with December of 2010, which was the first forecast that I personally produced. And you'll see since for the last couple of years, we have becoming more optimistic about the 15-17 biennium. Now, none of these forecasts were used until December of 2014 was the first time for the governor's recommended budget, and then the May forecast is what was used by the legislature. But nevertheless, this shows you how our thinking has gone, where in the dark days and 10, 11, and 12, we were becoming more pessimistic, and since then we've gotten back to where we were to begin with. So the resources are unchanged, from the revenue side, there's really no need for any sort of budget adjustments at this time, or no major ones. I wish the same could be said from the on the spending side. So, in terms of our biggest revenue source, the personal income tax, it looks still very healthy, growing at double-digit rates. But very much like the job growth, it does appear that we probably peaked sometime around the end of 2014, beginning of 2015. This is a three-month moving sum, so you see the bars are highest at the beginning of the year there. So it's about the exact same time as the job market peaked, I think, the growth. So, again, still quite healthy, but it looks like we've come off a little bit from the past. We're really seeing booms in corporate excise taxes in Oregon, and this has filtered into a bit of a stronger outlook for the current biennium. As you see here, over the last year and a half or so, we've gained about $250 million in net corporate taxes above where this $450 million a year was the pre-recession peak and where we got soon after that. Some of this is growth is explained by policies or state tax law and the like. In particular, the two big factors about $100 million of it, half of it is due to policy, and the two biggest factors being we enacted Measure 67, which increased the tax burden on corporations, and the second part of that would be we're starting to see some of these Betsy credits are they're still being realized, but we're past the peak, and so now fewer and fewer of these Betsy credits going forward are being cashed in. So that's part of it, but there's still another $100 million to explain, and that becomes a little bit harder because underlying profits, at least at the U.S. level, kind of flattened out over the last two or three years. We haven't really seen growth in profits, but yet we've seen this explosion in the corporate tax collections. And this would be a big departure from the past. In particular, since around the middle of the 1980s or so, we've really seen effective corporate tax rates erode across the country. Corporations are paying less because of tax competition among different jurisdictions and tax havens and the like. There are all sorts of reasons for it, but in general, this has been a downward trending story in terms of how many tax dollars states get per dollar of profitability. But that certainly is not the case here in the most recent months. Part of it, suspect, has to do with the new IT system. We're a bit further ahead on the personal income tax, getting ready for it, than for the corporate income tax, but there's still some uncertainty there bouncing around. So some of it might be technical, but nevertheless, some of it is probably real. So we've taken about $30 million of this extra growth and added it to the forecast for the current biennium.
We just heard about two drug companies merging, the main purpose of which appears to be to reduce their U.S. income taxes. It doesn't actually change profits. It simply moves them around to low-tax countries. We might argue whether that's appropriate or not, but it's certainly happening. I'm wondering if you know yet what effect our activity the last couple of sessions have been around tax havens, what effect that may have on these numbers.
Yes, Representative Barnett. We're watching carefully. We don't have the results yet of how much this is done. But nevertheless, it is on our radar, and it's something we've been talking with our advisory groups about to some extent. But still too early to tell. It is encouraging. I believe, Dr. Warner, correct me if I'm wrong, the original scoring was about $20 million on the first.
Annually, yes.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the interesting thing to me is when you use that term profits, we know that's a movable number based on accounting and tax haven activity, at least for very large businesses.
That's right. That's right, Representative Barnhart. And some of this might be that this is a U.S. profit number, too. Unfortunately, we don't have an Oregon profit number, and maybe we're doing quite a bit better. And so that could be, you know, explaining some of this as well. I should have mentioned as well. So one thing, most of this is going to be covered, I think, later by LRO. But for us right now, in terms of the income tax forecast, the personal income tax forecast, the question is still, the big question is, what about capital gains? What's going to happen to these non-wage kinds of very very volatile sorts of income sources? Right now, it looks like we're going to end the year in December at about exactly the same place we began the year in terms of equity prices or stock prices. It's going to be about a flat year when folks go and file their 2015 taxes. But while it was a flat year, there was a lot of churn. We had the big swing in the turmoil in the Chinese markets that caused a whole lot of volume and a whole lot of sales. And so right now, the character of our forecast is that we do see another big year of cap gains, even though we didn't see any, you know, significant growth in the stock prices. But then it comes off a good step over the next couple of years as the stock of unrealized gains has been depleted. But part of the problem to make it so volatile is that, you know, these non-wage forms of income are all in very few hands in Oregon. And this, you see here, these are numbers for tax returns that are subject to that Measure 66 top rate and how they did in 2014. We're matching full-year tax filers and following them, you know, over time here. And so that we're looking at the top 2%, roughly 2.2% of tax filers are subject to the higher rate, but for those they account for more than a quarter of all the tax due on those tax forms, and you know over two-thirds or around two-thirds of capital gains and Schedule E income, which I was going to put the standard deviations here because these ones that are big and that are really held in just a few hands are the ones that swing around and are most volatile. Roughly, the capital gains, Schedule E stuff is about twice as volatile as business income or wages, which in turn is about twice as volatile as some of our big retirement things, Social Security and pensions and the like. So we have, you know, this concentration is pretty impressive. When we're talking about 2%, that's like, you know, 33,000, 34,000 tax returns. That's comparable to a town the size of Medford or Gresham, about 33,000. So you know, but yet you know, responsible for a fourth of the income tax payments. Now, our burden is, and you're going to see this later today in some of the LRO materials. But our burden is kind of evenly spread across the income spectrum in Oregon, in terms of the share of our income that we pay to the state for taxes. That's kind of evenly spread. Most states are much more regressive, where low and middle income households in most states have a larger burden than they do here. There's not a right or wrong way in terms of the equity and the redistribution, but it's clear that we're an outlier because of our dependence here on the personal income tax. And so the tricky part is, as you look into these options for reform, if the goal of reform is to reduce volatility, it's almost impossible to do it without becoming more regressive. very difficult to do. If we institute any kind of consumption-based tax, well, that has a higher burden on lower-income households than high-income households. Property taxes, much the same way. Or if we were to change rates here among the different income tax factors, you're getting the same thing. It's very difficult, you know, given the instruments that we have to reduce volatility and at the same time retain the sort of progressivity we have in our system today, if that is a goal. But one place that does pull back on our on the progressivity of our system are excise taxes, or another word they sometimes called sin taxes. And boy, vice is sure alive and well in Oregon right now. We have just really booming growth in alcohol receipts and lottery funds. Criminal fines are growing at double-digit rates. We have marijuana just around the corner, and we're even under projecting the prison populations, particularly among women. So is encouraging for a bean counter, maybe it is sort of scary because of the Sodom and Gomorrah type thing. But with that, I'll let our resident expert on vice here, Josh, talk a little bit about the biggest one, which is lottery.
Thanks for that introduction.
We thought Mazen Malik was the expert on those issues.
For the record, cigarette sales are doing better than expected as well. Mark left that off. Lottery is growing today, particularly video lottery sales, the video lottery terminals you see in all your bars and restaurants and eating establishments across your districts. It's growing at double-digit rates today, and it has maintained this pace. Overall, gaming is up significantly nationwide. After 4 or 5 years of no growth, even losses in a lot of gaming establishments, casinos, whether state-run or tribal-run or private sector casinos, saw really, really poor gaming numbers for about 5 years. And a lot of it had to do with the economic cycle, but we also were worried about consumer preferences and taste changing. People want to play Xbox and not slot machines. However, that has reversed itself in the last year or so. Gaming is up everywhere except Atlantic City. Atlantic City is – their pace of their losses are slowing, but they still haven't fully bottomed out yet, it doesn't appear. But it's strongest here in Oregon, and we think some of that has to do with the new terminals. Every drinking and eating establishment, a lottery retailer in the state now has two new terminals in their places. Most of them have six machines. Two of the six are now new in terms of new technology, new games, new back office operations to increase performance and things like that. I guess that's not to increase performance, but to increase the operations from an IT perspective. A lot of these machines are really old. They're replacing some of the oldest ones first with the new technology, things like that. And the players have responded. Sales are up double digits. And again, but they're up 5-6% everywhere else. And so we're thinking beyond just the new machines, there's something
excuse
global.
Excuse me just
going.
A moment. Representative
Benz. Representative Benz.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at its heart, the lottery you're now explaining to us is regressive. Is that right? You're going to get to that. And I say regressive because those who generally play these games are generally at the low end of the income scale. That's my understanding, but I'd like to know if that's true.
Thanks, Representative Benz. In terms of gaming more broadly, I have not seen a really good study just on, say, Oregon video lottery players themselves. But on gaming more broadly, there's two things going on. First is a lot of the gaming revenue comes from the high-income folks because that's where all the money is, right? They are able to spend a large dollar volume on everything, cars, housing, food, and gaming is one of those expenditures. However, when you do it as a share of household expenditures, as a share of your income, you do see the regressive pattern where lower and moderate income households spend a larger share of their money on gaming activities. But in terms of pure dollar volume, at least when you look at, you know, casino activity and U.S. gaming activity, the pure dollar volume does tend to come more from the higher income folks. But again, that has to do more with how the income distribution looks in the country.
Thank you.
Can I follow up?
Yes, please. Yes, Senator Boquist.
Just to follow up on Representative Benz's questions to make sure I understand your answer here. You're talking about the United States as a whole. Is that not correct?
Senator Boquist, that is correct.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please. Yes.
So not much different than our income structure in Oregon, where you have a very small group generating most of the income, as you pointed out earlier, right? The numbers you're using in terms here are include Las Vegas, New Jersey, places where, you know, you roll $1 million on the dice. Am I correct?
Yes. Most of these studies that I've looked at are nationwide, yes.
Mr. Chair, just an observation. I mean, I've never played a lottery game or pulled one of those handles and so on and so forth here in Oregon. But having said that, I do meet my son once a week in an establishment for dinner because, you know, we kind of commute family thing. You know, there are still families out there. But my observation is, I think maybe close to what Representative Benz is if you look at these places, I don't see any of us in here pulling handles. I don't see the rich in any of these establishments playing these lottery games here in Oregon. And I happen to have had conversations with some of our fine tribal nation states that are our peers here in Oregon, and they're saying not what you're saying. They're saying revenue is going down and that they're struggling and that the people are playing who are low-income individuals. So I'm not sure I agree with your anecdotal United States broad because you have large, rich people who can throw money at this. Because what I see in my district is the poor playing it, and I see the typical vices, Mr. Chair, is that when you're in a recession, people drink and gamble. Mm-hmm. And, oh, by the way, for the record, as of October 15th, according to the United States government, we are in a manufacturing recession. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. What sort of data do we have on Oregon as compared to the rest of the country in this area? And do we have any specific data on the tribal casinos in Oregon? I know some of them share data with us and some of them don't.
Yeah, Representative Barnard, yeah. The lottery did commission a study a few years ago that talked about the character of their players. So that would probably be the best source we have for Oregon specific data. For the tribal casinos, unfortunately, a lot of them stopped reporting when they took this downturn. The Oregon video lottery lost about 25% of its sales in the recession. You know, pretty much overnight. The tribal casinos got about halfway down there and then stopped reporting. And so I'm not sure if they landed at the same place or how they've come out. I know it's you know, highly competitive, and they're competing against each other now and putting up Class B casinos next to already existing ones and the like. So there may be some competitive pressures there that the Oregon Lottery is somewhat shielded from.
Thank you. Please. I would simply note while we're talking about this topic, the Oregon Lottery, as my recollection is, came about as a result of an initiative petition sponsored by a company that actually produced lottery equipment and materials, not from inside Oregon, but from off. And I suspect the same thing is true in other places. This was in the 80s, I believe, when this started. I think it's safe to say that we have a very ambiguous view about the lottery. The idea that people actually spend significant amounts, some people spend significant percentages of their income playing the lottery is a difficult proposition, probably not a good proposition. The fact, of course, is that the state depends on the revenue that these games produce. And that gives us a very ambivalent view of these games. On the one hand, we applaud that the revenues are up. On the other hand, the fact that revenues are up mean that people are back playing the games. I suspect that Senator Boquist's assertion is absolutely correct, and that's unfortunate.
So adding up the changes to the forecast over the next few biennia, you'll see for the current biennium, 15-17, we actually have some more resources in terms of these revenues. We have $56 million more, about half lottery and half corporate taxes. Very much like corporate taxes, we have to believe some of this growth in lottery is real and permanent, and so we're going to take
you know, we're going to take some of it and add it to the outlook. For the future biennium, most of these movements have to do with personal income taxes, and those are moving as a result of changes in our macroeconomic inputs, particularly the composition of some of the income forecasts, wages versus business income, dividends, interest and rent, and whatnot changed from our vendor, and that's fed through into some differences as we get into the out years. But for the near term, we actually have some more resources in the immediate biennium. And very encouraging is where we're starting to get in terms of our budgetary reserves. We ended the last biennium just south of $1 billion, with the highest percentage of the general fund that we've ever been able to squirrel away, which is nice. It's not really it's not enough to offset a real recession. If we had a real recession starting today that was like the last one, it would take roughly $2 billion away from revenues. And so this would get us halfway there, but that wouldn't, of course, fix half the pain, because there would be issues on the spending side as well. If we were to have another severe recession, spending burden would go up as well, but that's less easy to track. And going forward, we expect really one more above average revenue growth year, and then when the job growth, you know, settles into this modest long-range pace, so too are our revenues expected to biannual growth of 9 or 10%, which is significantly below what we've seen in our history, and somewhat below what we expect the spending side to grow at as well.
Is this adjusted at all for inflation?
No, this is not.
These are just plain numbers.
Yeah, these are the raw numbers. Yes, yes.
Yeah, and do you have an inflation outlook?
Yes, we do.
Is that part of your presentation? If it is, we'll wait.
It's not. This is the last slide, and we were going to go to Q&A, so this is perfect. Representative Barnhart, yes, we do have an inflationary outlook. It is really still contained. We see as this wage growth starts to filter and push up, we are going to see some more prices push up, but not much more than 2% year over year at the U.S. level. That's the target that the monetary policymakers are looking at, and that's where the real consensus of forecasters has us anchored, without really any significant increase in inflation, although there are certainly inflationary risks, given that we have a lot of monetary policy left to unwind.
Thank you. Staying on the same topic just for a minute, and then we'll take questions from others. Going back to your immediate past slide, it seems to me that there are two key issues on this one, at least. There may be more I don't know about, but one is inflation, I already asked about. The other one is population growth. When you look at a number like 1995-97, we were in the middle of the tech boom. We had significant growth in that biennium, and I think the inflation was significantly higher than it is now as well, and maybe even population growth. Seems to me, in order for these numbers to actually make sense from a budgetary point of view, we'd need to know what the adjustments are like on at least those two factors, and there may be others that I don't attend to.
Absolutely, Representative Barnhart. We're wading into a ways and means conversation and out of a revenue group conversation. But the important thing, yeah, like you say, population growth and inflation. But from the budgetary perspective, it's really we're talking about caseload growth and the inflation that's important there are the compensation of state government workers and the health care cost, right? And those both are expected to grow at much higher than the 2% rate. Now this. We do feed the budget groups these different inflation factors from our models, and then they do with them what they will.
Well, I'm staying on the revenue side. I think our revenue, though, is related to inflation and population growth.
Oh.
I understand the point you're making about the budget side, but that wasn't the one I was really wanting to talk about. As we look at these numbers going out in the future, when you think about them as being biennial numbers, they don't look very big. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it, people get confused about that, but the biennial number of 8% is not a big number, unless population growth is gone and inflation is 2%. A comment on that observation, if you have one.
Yeah, no, understood, Representative Barnard. And this is very much like the economic outlook, that we're when we get done with this cyclical boost, there are a lot of weights on growth. In particular, it's the demographics. That's really what's driving a lot of this, and that we're just not going to be able to maintain the same rates of growth that we have in the past because of the loss of these very productive workers. And we're losing labor force as folks with a whole lifetime of experience are dropping out of the labor force. And so this in particular is a big weight. And it's also a big weight on spending because the older folks don't spend as much as do working age households. And so there are a lot of things that are going to push down all state tax instruments, and not just the one we use. Here is the personal income tax, so it's all about that core working age population. And for that very reason, we've seen a slowdown in the employment growth outlook. You see here not matching growth that we've seen in past expansions. Same being true for the revenue outlook. But unfortunately, there's no way out of it in terms of reform because other state tax instruments are similarly strained by the aging population, in particular general sales taxes, where older households don't buy a lot of the big durable goods like autos and sofas and whatnot, and home electronics and the like, that are really the base of sales taxes, whereas they do buy medical services and pharmaceuticals and some of the things that are often excluded. And so it's tough. All of the state major tax instruments are kind of facing downward pressure, and that I feel pretty strongly that it's going to be hard to match some of those previous year's gains.
We're in the same boat as Italy and Japan and not just Oregon, but the United States.
Absolutely.
Right. Thank you. I'm done with that line of questioning. Other questions? Yes, Senator Bershiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My assumption is that your forecast is based on interest rates remaining about zero. And have you done any model if the interest rates are bumped up? Have you looked at that?
Yes, Senator Chair. We in our model, our baseline now is saying that the first rate increase will come in 2 weeks. In December will be the first quarter point increase. And there's a pretty tight consensus here, too, among forecasters, that it's going to be a slow ramp up at that point somewhere and maxing out somewhere around 3.5%. But where it really hits for us is there's this conventional wisdom out there that as soon as the Fed starts tightening, that this is going to pull the wind out of the equity markets and that we're going to get some kind of stock market correction. Don't know if that's 100% the case, but it's certainly a widely held belief and something that's concerning us quite a bit. What we've done in terms of the outlook, like I said, is to have some of this swing in there and to have pull back some on these capital gains over the next couple of years, but it's not like a full-blown stock market crash. It's roughly we've torn off about half of the Band-Aid already. And so if we do have a real correction in market prices, we have some more cuts to the forecast to go.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Boquist.
Thank you. I have a series of questions, if you would indulge me, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Before I ask the questions, I want to make sure you dueling economists here, don't throw anything at each other, Dr. Warner, okay? Or correct here, because, you started out like FDR's happy days are here again. I'm looking at the first page of LRO's report, and you don't need to look at this, but I just want to make sure you agree with these new facts from the first page, which say, and I'll quote them so we understand, third quarter personal income tax collections are down $18 million. Third quarter corporate income tax collections are down $2.7 million. Oregon personal income is down $1.3 billion from September forecast, and Oregon employment is down 1,839 jobs from your September forecast. Are those correct?
Oh, yes, those are correct.
So happy days are here again, actually, from back then, not right now. Am I correct?
Oh, no, Senator. Actually, the personal income tax numbers are tracking very closely. The add personal and corporate together at $20 million, that's just a tiny frag. So that's very close. And moreover, that $20 million we were running behind has been more than made up in November. We're tracking well above that in November and so in October. So by November. October was big for both corporate and personal income taxes well exceeding the forecast. So on net, where we are right now for the first 4-5 months of the biennium is pretty much right on.
Well, sure. So what we're saying is that the forecast is right on.
That's right.
It's not
right.
That everything is booming above the forecast. It's the forecast is right on.
Correct.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
I think it was touched earlier here because, I mean, 2% growth, and I'm just trying to correct, and this is not a ways and means question. I'm just trying to put this to figure out for sure where we're going. And I haven't followed. I was gone for a week, so I didn't see the doom and gloom the Oregonian printed on, you know, PERS. But I understand there's doom and gloom out there that the PERS numbers are way up over the last articles last 2 weeks. But we're forecasting, generally speaking, about 2% growth over the next 4 or 5 years versus 8% is what we would need to keep PERS flat. Is that correct?
So for the revenue growth, general fund revenues, this, of course, doesn't have any of the property taxes in it or whatnot. But general fund revenues here, we're seeing annual growth rates of around 5% and over two-year periods around 10. So 4 or 5% a year in terms of our general fund and lottery resources.
Sure. So what I'm really saying is there going to be a deficit on the PERS side in the stock market? And if there's a correction, it's going to get worse. Am I correct,
Senator Bocas? That's absolutely correct. That although the equity markets can't you know either close the hole or double it, they do impact how fully funded we are, and you can see that during this last swing. If you look at the funding levels as we went through this last correction, there were some pretty big movements in those percentages in all states.
Final question, Mr. Chair. Looking at, you made mention a shift to rural areas in terms of population growth. It's interesting because, you know, in looking at my district, like the good representatives, two representatives to my left, we kind of watch what's going on. And, of course, I really don't want to be in Representative Bence's district. I was just through there recently, and it doesn't look like it's, you know, happy days are here again. I hate to say that, Representative. It looks pretty strained out there. But having said that, in my rural areas, I am seeing growth, population growth, but I'm not seeing workforce participation growth. What I'm seeing is individuals moving from into those areas because the housing is available because everybody left previously, and they're moving into low-income housing and rundown housing and things like that, and they're not participating in the workforce. And something that I saw a little bit, normally we see a big slide up here of workforce participation. And since we have a lot of the workforce that's not participating, at some point when that formula right there goes down to here and we're not going to be able to give checks out to them, some of them are going to have to go back to work. So what do you see as workforce participation in the forecast in front of us?
Yeah, Senator Boquist, we've didn't provide that slide this time, but in general, you know, we're still low on participation due to the business cycle. There are two things going on. Of course, there's the aging population. So even if every age group participated at the same rate as they did in 2000, that would give us about half of the drop we've seen in participation just because the population is aging out of the workforce years. So that's half of it, but half of it is largely due to the cycle and has to do with, you know, lack of job opportunities. Or at least lucrative ones. And with that, we've had really noisy data. The labor force data has been really bad the last few months, you know, since we did the benchmark, but it does look like we're starting to come back somewhat. We're not, you know, we're certainly not going to make up all that decline because a lot of it had to do with the aging population, and we may not even make all of the rest of this decline up to the extent that some of these job losses were permanent and now we have skills mismatches and things like that and weren't just a cyclical phenomenon. You know, that becomes, you know, a longer term issue. But we are seeing some improvement in labor force participation rates. We expect to see them continue to improve over the next 2 or 3 years just to get kind of back caught up to where, you know, the demographic, just as this cycle finishes out. Again, we're still in a catch-up mode in terms of the business cycle. We're not quite there yet. We're still growing at a little bit faster than, you know, sustainable pace. And as we do that, this will, you know, work up the participation rate some, but nevertheless, there's a big decline, and we are seeing these troubling declines across all age groups, particularly young workers, and that's the one that's most troubling because this is where people like to pick up a lot of skills.
Mr. Chair, I will jump onto this one because I mean, could you articulate what you just said here, the younger population? I mean, I don't want to be the doomsayer, but in my line of work, generally when that number reaches a certain threshold, I get employed. So you're saying, do you have any statistics to back up what you're saying here?
Yeah, say a bit more. I think that's the point, yeah.
Absolutely, Senator Boquist, do you want to take
that? Yeah, so two things here. Depends upon, young workers means 16 to 24. Summer jobs, part-time work, work during your college years, things like that. Those participation rate declines have been down substantially over the last 30 years. Basically, ever since the late 1990s, really the onset of the 2001 recession, since then they've been nothing but down. And so to what degree is it increased college enrollment? We've seen the millennials have higher college enrollment. They haven't necessarily obtained degrees all the way yet, but the increased college enrollment, that's taking out some of that. However, job opportunities for lower, less skilled, less experienced workers are really lacking because we've had other economic issues, right? We haven't been at full employment or economy operating at full capacity since 1999, really. And so we've seen a shift of older workers taking over some of these previously lower skilled, lower wage jobs out of necessity. Because the economy hasn't been great in the last 15 years. And so I think that's impacting the young workers. Some of it's the college enrollment. However, we've seen lower participation rates among working age households or working age, prime working age adults too, which is concerning. But they're only down, you know, they're down a couple percents, which it magnitudes a lot, but it's not like we've seen at the young workers. If we want to switch from labor force participation rates to employment rates, so the people that actually have a job, among 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds in Oregon, we're almost all the way back to where we were a decade ago. So the share that actually have a job has recovered. What we're missing and where we've seen a stock and potentially permanent losses are kind of in that 45 to 64-year-old cohort. The employment rates, the share of those folks with a job today is about 5 percentage points less than it was a decade ago. And given some of the labor market research we've seen in terms of, you know, if you look for a job for years and years and years, you become discouraged and you give up. And we've also seen there has been discrimination in the labor market against people that have long-term unemployment spells. There's some evidence of age discrimination and things like that. The scary thing is that's the permanent losses we've seen are those people that are kind of in their 40s and 50s and maybe early 60s to the extent that they've lost a job and are unable to find another one. The prospects for that are less bright.
Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Bentz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for your work on these issues. I do have to, Josh, clarify something because you may have misled whoever's listening to us today, and I just want to call out Malheur County's residential building permits issued over the past 3 years. In Malheur County, there were 29 issued in 2014. There were 27 issued in 2013 and 24 issued in 2012 out of a county of 33,000 people. Harney County's worse. I think it's like two issued in 14, four issued in 13, and seven issued in 12. Baker, 18, 22, and 22. So Senator Boquist's remark about this area being incredibly depressed is absolutely correct. And it plays out in people not wanting to invest the type of money it takes to build a new house in these areas. That's a comment. Here's my question, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of talk about raising the minimum wage, and I'm sure this will come up in what we're about to hear in the next presentation, and you kind of alluded to it when we talk about the declining employment of young people. There's been suggestions that the minimum wage be raised to $15 an hour. In Malheur County, it's currently $9.25. 100 yards away, it's $7.25 in Idaho. So if we went to $15, that would be more than twice the wage 100 yards away. But that's Idaho is the national average or the national minimum wage. We also have to talk about Mexico because many of the folks in my community actually have businesses in Mexico and import strawberries and the like from Mexico. So they compare the minimum wage they would have to pay in Malheur County to Mexico. And the difference is insanely different. And so my question to the two of you, of course, is if we raise the minimum wage here in Oregon, are you in a position to help us understand the consequences at these levels? And of course, it's a complex, incredibly complex question. which again I think will come up in our in the next presentation when we start talking about income inequality and the challenge that goes with wanting to have people have a living wage. But my question to you is, have you guys done the studies so that you can help educate us when it comes to the consequences of raising this minimum wage? What I know what it's going to do to my county, Malheur County. It's going to destroy it. You don't need to. I don't need to study for that. The people will zoom out. They've already told me it would be insanity to pay twice 100 yards away from where you could pay half. And so people will actually get a pay cut. Those now getting $9.25 an hour will soon get $7.25 an hour. But so I don't need to know about Malheur County, but I sure would like to know if you guys have done the work, because we need to know.
Yeah, Representative Benz, Representative Barnhart, luckily policy isn't our thing. So we get to steer clear of some of these more toxic debates. Just a couple of comments on this. One is that one size fits all in terms of the minimum wage is probably not the most efficient way to go. I think people can probably agree on that. Most economists would. And the second comment is in terms of people bringing concerns to me, exactly the example you're talking about are where we have businesses in Oregon who are most concerned about it would be someone like a food processor who sells their goods on a global market, so they have to take whatever price is out there. And so if you know your food processor right on the border of Idaho, there's no reason per se to move it other than unless if those costs aren't, you know, prohibitive. And so I think that is where you would probably see, you know, that's a good example of where, you know, you could get some distortions would be exactly that sort of firm.
Please. I just want to mention, I had a long conversation with a gentleman who farms on Savi Island. He's a long way from Malheur County. And he was the one indicating that the competition out of Mexico for strawberries was going to destroy him. Was already destroying him at our current minimum wage rate, and should it go higher, he would have even more difficulty competing. In fact, he moved to Mexico, and I'm not joking. That was exactly the conversation. That was Savi Island. So I'm trying to say this is a statewide thing. This is not a border thing. Sure. Statewide. And in that regard, my second question. It happens that the cattle market just dropped 30%. Mm-hmm. Some people up here raise cattle. And my brothers had a sale yesterday, and they indeed took just 30% less this year than last. That commodity, debacle, is also happening across the nation. I didn't hear much about that, other than the reference to manufacturing. Is Oregon immune from these commodity price drops, or where was that in the report? I'm sure it's there. I just need to know where.
Yeah, Representative Benz, we probably should have done a better job of fleshing this out. In general, in terms of the biggest commodity, the energy commodities, and that's what's hitting the manufacturing stream, those on the long term for the typical Oregonian aren't a bad thing because every firm and every household does consume energy. That said, at the front end, well, we've seen we already had one shuttered metal maker who supplies mining equipment. Sure, you know, that pain is front-loaded, and so we're seeing a lot of that in terms of the manufacturing pipeline. But broader commodity prices are important for Oregon. The saying, you know, as the price of wheat goes, so goes Eastern Oregon. And that's still true to this day. And we have, of course, lumber prices, you know, and are also, you know, hugely important. So they're quite a, you know, commodity prices are, you know, multifaceted. But we, a lot of our producers and our, particularly our resource industries, will take a hit. And the cattle prices are associated with these other energy prices and the like.
Thank you.
Senator Brisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Josh, a while back you were talking about jobs, and then you said jobs and then lucrative jobs. What's the definition of those two?
Senator, that's a very fuzzy definition.
But I was worried
when we focus on what we call job polarization, which we've brought to you guys before a number of times over the years, where you got low wage jobs, middle wage jobs, high wage jobs, right? We're lacking in the middle. Those are generally somewhere around the state median to the state average. So full time jobs, $35,000 to maybe $45,000-$50,000 a year. That's sort of the middle. It's not necessarily, we're not saying that's middle class or your purchasing power is good enough to afford, you know, the American dream or what have you, but that's the middle section of the economy. Those are the wages that are paid. Low wages are less than that, you know, $20,000, $25,000 a year. High-wage jobs are 60 and above, roughly speaking, in terms of how, when you look at the occupations out there in the Oregon economy, that's just kind of how they line up in terms of the distribution.
I guess legislators are low-paid jobs.
I think a lot of Oregonians don't know that, but the fact is it's true, yes. Other questions? We still have several minutes on this item if we get to. Let me ask a couple then. At one point you used the term bad, I think, in reference to data. And it wasn't clear to me whether you meant bad in the sense of negative or whether you meant bad in the sense of reliability and perhaps consistency.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Representative Barnett. Let me be clear. Bad in terms of reliability and consistency. You know, the IT system replacement in terms of DOR had to be done to move away from the green screens to avoid some catastrophic issues with collections. So this had to be done, but from a research perspective, either LRO or ourselves, you know, obviously it's a bit intimidating, you know, not having our instruments when we're flying the plane. So we'll get that cleared out, you know, as quickly as possible, and they're certainly working hard on it over at DOR.
Great, good. Anything else, Senator Boquist?
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up to that, so we'll rat out DOR here. I mean, I'm a little concerned. I mean, we've all monitored this DOR. I think we've heard the reports. We're kind of on track, and things are going well, but it sounds to me like the economists here are saying that things aren't on track, things aren't going well over there, and there are problems.
Well, that isn't quite what you said, is it?
No, Representative Barnett, it's a process. We're not through the process yet. We just haven't even begun for personal income. We're just begun. But it's a process, and as we've worked through this, corporate taxes are learning more and more about the data as they're digging into it. We don't know all the problems until we, you know, get our hands dirty. And so that's the, you know, and I think it's going to be a long one. But we are working through it. In terms of their quality measures and their project management tracking, I don't believe this is on the radar.
Paul, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please. Yeah.
I'm not tracking here. So are you saying you're not getting the data that you previously got? The new system won't give you that data? Or are you saying that it's coming in as such a new form you can't analyze it and figure out how to track it? Or what do you mean?
Yeah, Senator Boquist, so the process is trying to make the new data consistent with what we've seen in the past and to really understand what the new data is. And that's one of the first steps, is to say, okay, we understood the old data. Can we, you know, can we replicate this with the new systems? And as we, you know, find out some things you can, some things you can't, and learning more about what, you know, the character of the new systems are. For me, not to get too deep into the weeds, but the issue is, you know, it's a processing system, and it's about payment processing, and the most important thing is saying, okay, this is the bottom line, how much you owe, you know, based on how much your liability was and how much the stream of payments, and they've got that hammered down very well because that's what the firm does. But from a research perspective, we kind of have to know why you owe that money. We have to be able to tie it to a stock sale or a job or profits in your business, and then, you know, in order to do what we do, we have to be able to make that mapping, and that's not as natural in their system. It's a billing system.
So that data that you could get before is not available now, or you haven't found where it's available yet?
Starting to be so. They're more and more getting on top of it. Some of the transaction stuff is still not going to ever completely match up, and we're still learning some things about that, and we'll find out when we open up the new program as well. But the timing's a little bit different about when these revenues hit the stream. And for us, you know, like, that's everything. We need to tie that timing to the economy, and then we have some hope of getting a projection right.
They've recategorized some things in order to make life easier for them. Is that what you're talking about, or are you talking about something else?
Representative Barnard, it's really something else. Some things are recategorized, but really everything is. It's a whole new system. So each payment is coded differently than it was before. Absolutely everything is new and different. And so that's a complicated, it's a big task.
Making two tables that are equivalent to each other is taking time.
That's correct. And they've been able to do the big ones for Corp now in terms of the main monthly financial statement. They have that all hammered out. The only issue is, are kind of these transactions over time right now is the biggest missing piece that they're still, you know, we're still.
Part of what they have claimed is that they'll actually be able to provide more data in the future. It sounds like getting there has some growing pains.
Yes, Representative Barnett, there is one item that we will get that other states have picked that we've been jealous about for some time, and that's these payments with returns in April. We just isolate exactly the payment that comes out with that April check, and that we don't have right now, and that will be nice to have. But that's the only case I know where we're gaining rather than losing info. But we're not losing too much right now on the corporate side. But it's going to take us a while to find out what we've lost, you know, as we work with it.
Senator Boquist, anything else on this one?
Oh, no, I'm just cheery this morning, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I want to go back several topics and talk a little bit more about the demographics. And I don't know if you guys do this type of analysis or not, but I'm trying to understand what the net effect is of – as we have the retirements, you know, we talk about low labor participation rates, and particularly between the 45 to 60-year-old cohort. But with all the baby boomers retiring, is that not leaving sort of a lot more opportunity? I mean, on one hand, I hear low labor participation rates, depressed wages. Then on the other hand, I hear employers and state agencies saying, where are we going to get the workers for tomorrow? And I just have a hard time reconciling that. So that's part number one. Do you have some sort of commentary on that? Part number two is as higher cost workers retire and they're shifted onto the PERS system, have you done any analysis about what the cost of labor is with employees as the average age of a state worker or public sector worker that hasn't stepped, you know, had as many years of step increases and, mm-hmm. you know, maxed out on that. What's the effect of that?
Yeah, Representative Barnett, Senator Edwards, this is not just a state worker issue. It's everybody. This is really why we're getting this weight on growth, is because we're losing highly paid, highly effective people and replacing them by lower paid junior folks. And so that is a big dynamic, not just for the state, but for the labor market as a whole. And you're right; they're very much in demand to the extent that this, you know, aging population is the labor force disease, bringing in these working age young cohorts. You know, that's the cure. And, you know, we do have some areas in the state that are doing pretty well with that, particularly relative to other states. So that's somewhat encouraging. But you're absolutely right. There's a lot of concern right now about the labor supply and how much of it's going to be there for us, given that we have a little bit of a sag in the middle of the population cohort. That said, the millennials are a big population cohort, too. And it'll just take some time before they, you know, they have the experience.
I'll just add one thing. The millennials, at least in Oregon and nationwide numbers, not true in every county or every place, are bigger than the baby boomers, right? And so as the baby boomers exit, the millennials are stepping into their place in the workforce by and large. And so the net growth rates are really low. We're talking 1% job growth in a few years' time in our forecast. So the net growth is really low, but it's going to hide some of that generational churn that you're talking about, right? As just because with every baby – to get net job growth, right, for every retiring baby boomer, you have to hire two people. You have to hire one to first fill that job. Otherwise, that'd represent a loss of a job. And then you have to hire someone on top of that. And so you're going to see a lot more generational churn over the coming 10, 15 years, even as those net growth rates are quite low.
Okay. Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for, again, another very enlightening report. We look forward to reading the official report that I understand you'll be have on your website later today.
Yeah, sorry, if it's not there already.
Okay.
It's supposed to go up when we started. But
thank you. And we look forward to to many more enlightening reports. I will simply say that this report is not full of surprises, which generally means that we like it. Thank you very much. And with that, committee, we'll take a recess for 10 minutes, and then we'll go on to hear about options for restructuring Oregon state and local revenue system scheduled for 10 o'clock. And with that, the committees are in recess.
It was so bad we had to cancel the hearing.
All right.
Oh, no.
The committees will come back to order, and we will now hear from the Legislative Revenue Office on options for restructuring Oregon state and local revenue system. Okay, Paul and Chris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office, and Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. As you recall, in the at the end of the 15 session, House Bill 2171, which was your omnibus tax credit bill, you put in a directive to us to analyze potential tax reform options, and that was in Section 1 of the bill, and it's in Appendix A of the report. We went ahead and broke our custom and gave you hard copies of the report. So I'm going to kind of walk through that with you, so we'll give you a chance something to write on and refer to as we go through it. We do see this as more of kind of a progress report. It's an issue I know that you're working on in general, a long-term issue, and have been working. Many of you have been working on it for many years. We tried to start it at kind of where we are, where we think we are now in terms of the work that the committee has done. And one of the key things we used as a starting point was the 2009 report that came from the Revenue Restructuring Task Force that Lane Shetterly chaired, you may recall, and made some reference to that. But that was largely setting some of the issues or the kind of the beginning point or what I call premises. A couple of things I wanted to say first, though. One of the things we did was we did set up an advisory group, a technical advisory group, to help us. They helped us update our OTIM model and reviewed it, gave us some good comments, and I really want to express thanks to them. Fred Thompson at Willamette, Jeff Reimer at Oregon State, Steve Robinson with Decision Metrics, John Toponio at Echo Northwest, and our state economist, Mark McMullen. So really appreciate the input they provided. And anything that's misrepresented in the paper, we'll blame them for it. So if you look at the report, it's arranged. We have a key findings part, and I'll defer that till the end and go through it when we get to that in the body of the text. But I wanted to point out the three really basic premises that we started from. And rather than spend a lot of time and verbiage trying to document these, we think we've documented them in committee pretty well. And these are things that I think are pretty well accepted. And the premises are, number one, the state system is highly volatile. We know that the dependence on the personal income tax is a key factor. Mark McMullen just showed you those volatile components, the Schedule E income, the capital gains income. These are powerful revenue sources, but they're also extremely volatile and hard to predict. So, and of course, the corporate income tax is even harder to predict. So the result is we have a system that's very volatile over the course of the business cycle. The second premise is the local system, because of the property tax, constitutional property tax limitation, is very rigid. And the rigidity within the system, particularly caused by Measure 50 and the value limits, has created especially some horizontal inequities in the system, where taxpayers in an equal position, getting the same level of public services, having the same market value home, are paying different taxes. And that's a classic violation of horizontal equity. We also would point out that I think one of the indirect consequences of both the Measure 5 and 50 was really policy retrenchment on low household income property tax relief, which was a major part of legislative policy in the 1980s. The HARP program, for example, those went away with the broad property tax relief measure. So that was kind of, and we will see some of the analysis we've done of the impact of property taxes at the low end. And finally, both systems lack diversification because the state system most dependent on the personal income tax, almost 70% of collections. Property tax is the dominant source overwhelmingly in the local system. So what we've done in this first section is go through and look at those major tax sources and determine what type of options there are around the property tax initially. If you look at kind of our discussion around the property tax, is one of the points we do try to make here in this first paragraph is that programs such as HARP are phased out in response to the revenue losses brought on by the initiatives. And that's what's led to the discussion around what are the potential options there to help solve that problem. And one of the things that we looked at was the possibility of providing relief to low-income households. And let me show, jump around just a bit to the back page of your report, the Appendix C. It's the very back of it. You'll see a table there, the very back page, a table there that is our distribution of individual taxes by household income group. This is the result of the OTIM analysis that we've run on tax incidents. And if you look at the less than $20,000 household income group, notice that they have a higher effective tax rate than most other income groups. And the primary reason for that is the residential property tax at 3.76%. So this is an effective rate. So it's the taxes divided by their household income. So the primary reason why you get that kind of a regressive tail there is the residential property tax. And notice that we've broken out the other components of the property tax, the business property tax, there you see a much lower effective tax rate from that side because that largely falls on owners of capital. So that's one of the key elements behind what we're looking at in terms of potential solutions for the property tax is some way to direct tax relief to that group. And the two ways really to do that.
Can you explain then, since a lot in that category are renters, how the property tax problem fits in with that? Maybe you mentioned I missed it.
Mr. Chair, the renters would not show up as owner-occupied in this category. So they would be separate from that.
Okay.
They would pay that portion of the tax. You notice that while they'll actually pay a portion of the property tax paid by the owners of that rental unit.
So these are just the households?
These are the households, yes. Okay. And they're predominantly elderly. So where you have relatively low current income, and yet you have property ownership. And so you have a high ownership rate for that group.
Okay.
Now, the way to direct tax relief to them, there's really two ways. One is through a homestead exemption, something that I know the committees have looked at in the past. Homestead exemption could be set up as a fixed amount. And what you'll see as we go through our simulations, we ran a number of simulations with homestead exemption amounts in it. And, of course, the way that would work is if you had a homestead exemption of, say, $20,000, it would be a higher percentage of a $100,000 house than it would be of a $500,000 house. So everybody would get that exemption, but it would have a proportionally greater impact on low-income individuals. And you'll see when we run those simulations, that group, that $20,000 group benefits from that more than other groups, as you'd expect. The other way to do this, and we didn't run simulations on this, would be through some type of a circuit breaker where homeowners could, if their property taxes exceeded a certain percentage of their income, then they could get a tax credit on their personal income tax. A number of states do this so that you kind of put a lid on what percentage people will pay in property taxes. And that would be a way to address that group. So the other issue that we looked at was the issue around rigidity caused by the fact that we have this separation or diversion between market value and assessed value. And that, of course, is created by Measure 50. And what Measure 50 has done is now if you look at the overall data stream for 14-15, the total property in the state is assessed at about 75% of real market value. And this is ignoring specially assessed property. So about 75% of market value. So there's about 25% there. So one possibility to look at in terms of revenue raising would be to move toward market value. And that could be done in a number of ways. And we've listed some of those here. If you look on page four, we've listed the ways to try to return to market value. And these are things that you've heard in the past. One is to return to market value at time of sale. This would move you in the direction of market value at some point in the future. Of course, what happens is it's a slow way to do it because you only have that return to market value when a transaction takes place. And at any point in time, you're going to still see a lot of horizontal inequities. And that particularly, you see this in the California data from Proposition 13, that elderly people that have lived in their houses a long time, they really benefit from that because they haven't turned over the house. Younger families that have just recently bought the house would pay a higher effective rate. But over time, there would be some movement to market value, which we don't have in the current system. Now you've locked in with it. Only when you have an exception value in the Measure 50 system do you have any kind of change. And even at that point, you change to the change property ratio, which is just the average for the county for that class of property. So this would be one way to do it. Another thing that's been, and you've heard these discussions, particularly from the cities and counties, would be a way to adjust that change property ratio. Again, that's you're taking the change property ratio, you're looking at residential property for the entire county, and what is the average assessment ratio? That becomes the change property ratio. So if you are to have an exception value, you, for example, subdivide your area, it would go to the change property ratio. If you wanted to push that up toward market value, you could set a lid under that so that it would gradually move toward market value over time. But this would be a very gradual approach because you have to have an exception for that to become relevant. The third point we raised is the something that we think would be very practical to go to market value would be to look at some multi-year average. So if you wanted to your assessed value for 2015, for example, you could say that it's 50% of your market value in 15, 30% of your market value in 14, 20% of your market value in 13, something like that. So you have this moving average so that you would always be moving toward market value. You'd eliminate the inflexibility in the system, but on the other hand, it would always, you'd always be moving forward. You wouldn't ever be exactly at current market value, but you'd be some function of recent market value. So those are the things we looked at. If you look at the paragraph here at the bottom, all of these approaches would add flexibility, but they all require a constitutional amendment. And again, I'm thinking back to where the 2009 task force got to, and they would likely be a transition period which was disruptive for homeowners or for property owners in general as you're making this adjustment, because you have such a wide variability now in the ratio of assessed value to market value. Some people it wouldn't affect at all. My home in Salem, for example, is this already assessed at market value. But for others, particularly in the Multnomah County area, Portland area, you'd have a huge change. So it's kind of unavoidable in terms of the disruptions. But if you are to go down this path, we recommend that you really Senator look at some way to phase it in.
Paul, I mean, if we went after any of those three approaches, that wouldn't that spur some lawsuits over Measure 50?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bertschinger, you would have to pass a constitutional amendment. I mean, that's, as I mentioned there, that's one of the big obstacles. And, of course, the people would have to agree with it and approve that amendment. So it would be going forward. I mean, you wouldn't be saying that somebody's property in 2014 has to reflect a new assessment, but somebody's property going forward would be subject to the constitutional amendment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that's kind of where we are with property taxes. Number one is, if you want to address an issue we think that comes up when we do the analysis of the distribution of the property tax and the historical fact that we have avoided or moved away from ways to help low-income households address the property tax issues. And, of course, the committees were inundated with this, with the senior deferral issue over the last several sessions. And you heard a lot of testimony about people that struggle to pay their property taxes. There are options to look at in that regard. But in terms of making adjustments to the Measure 50 values, that's probably a steeper logistical cliff to climb, although there's certainly options to do that. And we do have some work in progress on some constitutional amendments that for discussion in the 16th session. The next issue was around taxing consumption that was listed in the bill. And we identify really four basic bases. The first is the traditional retail sales tax. They all vary, of course, for the 45 states that have one, but we tend to use the Washington base. And it has the standard exemptions in it, food for home consumption. Most services are exempt, for example. What we do in terms of estimating the revenue from the Washington base is we take the Oregon economy, the Washington economy. We use the Washington Department of Revenue Tax Expenditure Report, and that gives us an estimate of what the base is. The Office of the Forecast Council projects the base as a percentage of their personal income, so we apply that to our personal income. So we scale it to Oregon's size. So a 1% rate for the 17-19 biennium would generate about $1.4 billion. And we think this would be linear, at least up to 6 or 7%.
By linear, you mean you would simply multiply $1.4 billion by the percent number?
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We've also added in, and Washington State Department of Revenue gives us estimates of what they think the tax expenditure is from their services. So we proportion those and build those into their base and apply it to Oregon, and we think that would expand the base by almost a third. So, but this would be a wide group of services, including things like medical services, for example, that are a big chunk of consumer spending that's not taxed in any state now. But that's one of the reform recommendations that you often see is, well, we need to, because the current base, the Washington-style base, is shrinking, you need to add services. But we don't see any implementation of that on any kind of a widespread degree at all in any of the states. So it's not been something we can look to a successful model for. The reason why, and if you look at Washington's base, go back to the early 80s, Washington's base was about 50% of its income. Now it's about 35%. So there's this long, gradual decline in the retail sales tax base. It's due to the services, and it's due to remote sales. So that's a real issue going to a traditional retail sales tax, and the more we look at it, the more we become convinced that that's a major problem going forward.
Is demographics also an issue?
Demographics is potentially an issue as well. As state economist was saying, you do see a drop-off in consumer spending as people age. However, I would say that consumption drops less than income does. Uh-huh. And so you have this kind of a life cycle spending, but still it does drop, yes. So the other two bases we looked at were gross receipts and value added. Gross receipts is a much broader base, so you can generate the same amount of revenue as you do with a 1% retail sales tax with a quarter of a percent gross receipts tax. What we used here for our scaling to Oregon was the Ohio CAT. And we'll talk a lot more about that because most of our simulations for consumption taxes, all of them, in fact, use a CAT type base. The CAT base applies to all entities, so it's not a particular C corp or anything like that. All business entities pay it, and it also has it's a destination-based tax, meaning it's sales taking place in Ohio. So if you produce something in Ohio and sell it to Illinois, it's not subject to the CAT. But if you produce something in Illinois and sell it into Ohio, it is. So it's a privilege tax, the privilege of making sales in Ohio. So in that sense, it has some real similarities to our apportionment formula, which is based on Oregon sales.
The income tax apportionment formula, is that what you're referring to?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So the other approach we looked at, and we spent time on this in the past, and spent one session really working on this, is a value-added approach. The biggest concern we have about that approach is, although theoretically it's a sound approach for taxing consumption, most economists would recommend it, and I think it would work well at a national level, where you can. The difference between a value-added and a gross receipts tax is gross receipts, you're taking total sales, the top line on your tax return. Value-added, you're taking only the components of value you add. And that can be measured two ways. One is you can take those total sales and subtract out all your purchases from other businesses. It's called the invoice method. That's what the Europeans use. So that's the value-added you have. The other way to do it is a sum up your value added by your labor, your capital, your rent, which reflect the use of your resources to produce your product, not the things you bought from other businesses.
Senator Haas.
Thank you. Paul, when we worked on the CIT tax in this committee, we talked about the dynamic of pyramiding.
Yes.
Could you explain what that, and I think it was your counsel, that's why you want to keep your gross receipts tax if you're going to have one at a lower rate to eliminate that. Can you explain exactly what that does and if it grows exponentially as the rate goes up and if value added is the way to escape that?
That's great, Mr. Chair. The biggest criticism of the CAT and other and the business and occupation tax in Washington, the gross receipts taxes, is this prospect of pyramiding. And that's because the gross receipts are based on that top line number. So it's based on the total sales of that business. So if you have total sales of a certain amount, the rate applies to that. If you build that into your pricing and then sell it to the next stage of production, now they've got a higher price they pay, and then they also have to pay the gross receipts on that. So in effect, you're having this compounding impact. So that's the pyramiding phenomenon, where you add 2% at each stage of production or 0.5% at each stage. It will be more than 0.5% as it compounds through the production process to the final product price. So that's pyramiding. Value-added taxes eliminate that because it's only the value that that company adds to the process that pays. And that's why most countries prefer it. Nearly all, I think every developed country except the U.S. has a value-added tax. But what they do, and the problem that this creates at the state level, the European countries, if you're paying the VAT in the United Kingdom, for example, you would take your value-added. And then for anything you sold outside the United Kingdom, anything you exported, you'd get a tax credit. So what that does is you don't put competitive disadvantage for your exporters, and you convert it into really domestic tax. But you have to use that credit system to do that. At the state level, essentially a destination-based tax. But you can convert it to at the state level, and you can do it through the sum-up method, or the income method. And the only example we have of that is in the business enterprise tax in New Hampshire. And what they do is sum up the labor, the rent for natural resources, interest to reflect capital, and then that is a very simple return. They're like a one-page return, and that becomes your BET liability. The reason for using the income approach at the state level is you would run into constitutional problems if Oregon tried to impose a value-added tax and then give an export credit for selling products to Washington, for example. So you couldn't implement it legally within a federalist system.
It becomes a problem with interstate commerce.
Yeah,
I have a question related to Chair Hass's question. The base of the Ohio tax, this gross receipts, the third item in that table, what's the base? I mean, who has to pay that?
All entities pay that tax. In Ohio, there's a threshold of $1 million. So it's in Ohio, it's 0.26% of gross receipts above $1 million for all businesses that make sales in Ohio. And so if it's called sits use in Ohio. So there is a privilege of making those sales in Ohio.
Does that include services?
Yes.
So a small law firm that grosses $300,000 would not pay it, or a small manufacturer, but anybody who grossed more than $1 million would pay on the portion above $1 million.
Mr. Chair, it's like our minimum. It's $150. If you're less than $1 million, it's $150, and then it's 0.25% for anything above $1 million. So, and of course, you know from your corporate minimum discussions, $1 million, of course, is a very small amount.
Right.
So it's pretty broad base, and that's why they're able to have a 0.25% rate. They generate more money than we would estimate here because they're a lot bigger than we are. But you can still see with a 0.25% rate that you would generate $1.3 billion in Oregon for the biennium. That's using the Ohio rate.
Great. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Just a clarification on your chart here. Is that all entities, or is that like Ohio $1 million?
The estimate here is drawn from the Ohio base, so it includes the Ohio threshold amount.
Right.
So I've scaled it to, I've taken Ohio's economy, taken their collections, and fit them together. Now, when we go through and run the simulations, we didn't do that. We just, we weren't that sophisticated. We just assumed that gross receipts by that percentage.
But in theory, what you're talking about is the Ohio base, which is the first million is a minimum of X, and then everything over 2%. I do have a question, Mr. Chair, back on pyramiding.
Yeah, sure.
Just to clarify, in pyramiding, I'm only using an example because it just jumps to mind. So if you had two entities, and this happens, we'll just force products industry. If you have an entity in pyramiding, which you're talking about, a practical example, if you grow timber, you're a small woodland, and you spend more than X, right, you have to pay the percentage for your gross receipts there. Then it goes to the sawmill. The sawmill has to pay it there. Then it goes to the, if it's using a distributor, right, or a deal, it's paid there. And then when it ends up at Home Depot, they're going to pay there. So that's you can end up with four tiers, theoretically, correct?
That's correct, Senator. And again, that's why you get, a lot lower rate generates almost the same amount as a retail sales tax.
Sure,
and that's just because that base is so broad.
So, follow-up question, Mr. Chair. In example two, if you were a consolidated corporation, large entity, both sides are paying, but you own your own timber, you own your own sawmill, and you could put and deliver it straight to Home Depot, you would have a market advantage. Is that not correct?
That's correct, Mr. Vice Chair. And that, of course, is one of the responses, is this vertical integration would be a way to reduce your tax liability.
One final question.
Yeah, please.
And in theory, in Oregon, in pyramiding, if you were a PUC-regulated entity, that increase could go into your rate formula, or if you were an insurance commission overseeing, that could go into your insurance commission rate formula, or if you were a healthcare provider under CMS, that same cost could go into all three of those modelings, and therefore you might, in theory, be held harmless as a corporation.
Well, Mr. Vice Chair, if you're looking at regulated pricing, it would be treated as a state and local tax that you can build in.
Thank you. Senator Hass?
No.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're getting pretty close to, Senator Book was getting pretty close to my question, but do you have in the materials here the regressive nature of each of these, or how regressive each one turns out to be? And in my conversations with utilities on gross receipts tax, of course, they're going to pass it instantly on. Thus, it's one would think regressive. But that's my question. Are you going to call that out in each of your models?
Representative Benz, we did not run simulations on these individual taxes. We ran them as part of a package. So you'll see how it affects things as part of a package. We could certainly run them individually. But when we look at these packages, we try to make them revenue neutral or gain a certain amount of revenue or lose a certain amount of revenue. So, and you can see some of those they're not pure effects from these, but you're certainly right that normally the effect of a gross receipts tax or any consumption tax is to be generally regressive. In our analysis, we think the CAT shows up less than a retail sales tax, or tends to. And one of the things that comes into play, I think, is it comes in as a business expense for a wide variety of businesses, and that in turn affects some of their pass-through income. So therefore, you can get some impact in upper middle and higher income. And that's so there is some CAT distribution going there in the model.
Could you say a little more about that? Is that related to something like the ability to raise your price or other kinds of things of that sort? Or whether you're a business that includes out-of-state sales? Or
Mr. Chair, both those things are correct. It affects your ability to raise your price. In our models, you are either selling domestically in the Oregon market, or you're exporting. If you're exporting, you're what we call a price taker. You can't shift the tax onto people in Idaho. The presumption is that you're at competitive equilibrium now, and if you try to shift that on, you'll lose your market share.
And it may work the other way around as well, I assume, if you're dealing with businesses, in this case, that gross less than $1 million, they don't have to pay the tax. You're trying to compete with them. One presumes you may have difficulty raising your prices. You,
Mr. Chair, that's correct. You may see some shifting, yes.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to go back to your point about the shifting to online acquisition and that leakage, if that's the right word for it. Just do you got in your models, is that taken into account each time, or at least referenced?
The loss of remote sales, or the fact that you can't collect tax from out of state competitors.
Follow up. The thought was, if there was one of these taxes, gross receipts tax, and the company decided it wanted to pass that tax on in Oregon because that's the only place it would be assessed, then they raise their prices, driving people to the online market, and thus we lose twice. Or at least the company certainly loses. That's the question.
Representative Benz, that would be a question of of consumer sensitivity. The more consumer sensitivity you have, the bigger what economists would call a distortion. So if you've got other options out there, you live near a border area, or you can purchase the same product through the Internet, you're going to be more sensitive. You're going to have higher elasticity of demand, and therefore we collect less revenue from that tax, and you change behavior more than if there weren't those options available. So those things are factored into our incidence analysis.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Senator Edwards?
Yeah, could you comment again on the value-added approach? And you said the ways of calculating value-added and which one has constitutional issues and which one doesn't. Can you explain that again?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes. I have the same problem.
Senator Edwards, you can get to value-added two ways. You can take your total sales, and then just subtract out all your purchases you made from and Senator Boquist's example, from the different stages of production, from your timber you purchased, and so forth. That would be called the invoice method, and that's the way they do it primarily in Europe, for example. The other approach would be to sum up. Since you're taking the value that your business adds, you can take your payments you make to your factors of production. So what are my payments to labor? What are my payments to capital, which would be interest? What are my payments to the natural resources? Those are the three factors of production. So if you look at those payments, then that's the value that your company added. And so that becomes your value-added base. and all of that stuff. And we've done this. I don't know if there's anybody here that remembers the BAT, which was the business activity tax that we spent a lot of time working on. That was how we approached the BAT, and we actually worked with the Department of Revenue to set up a tax return based on a BAT. And what it would do is take all that information you got to report on your corporate income tax, but there are things that are costs on your corporate income tax, and those would be your base. So your labor costs, you know, you deduct those, right, on your corporate income tax, but in the value-added tax, that would be part of your base. And that would be the biggest part, usually, would be your labor expenses.
So what was the interplay between, or maybe I'm mixing it up with something else you said, but the constitutional issue and one way of calculating the value add, or was it the credit?
Yeah, the constitutional issue revolves around the credit. And if you go through and use that income method, it really becomes a source-based tax. What that means is it's based on your factors of production. And that's why I referred to the apportionment debates you've had in the legislature around the sales factor. Remember, the apportionment used to be property, payroll, and sales. Well, property and payroll are really source-based measures. That's where you're producing your good. So if you use that income approach, you're back to a source-based measurement. For most states, they're concerned, as Oregon has been, with the impact that has on competitive position, because you can't pass those on. Whereas if you have a more destination-based tax, then you're talking about the companies that are all affected by that tax competing with one another in your state, then you don't see those same interstate competition issues.
Clarifying question then. So it doesn't matter how you calculate, how you arrive at the value added. There's a constitutional problem with crediting back
For your exports. Yes.
Exactly. So it doesn't matter how you calculate it.
It's right. It's just a problem. You can theoretically get to the same thing, yes.
It's considered a discrimination based on whether your company is in or out of state, and that would be a violation of the Commerce Clause.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. We're talking about the federal constitution here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Clear as mud.
Yes. And it's also why the only other state that we've seen that has exercised the value-added approach is Michigan. For a number of years, they had what was called the single business tax, and they finally moved away from it. And there's a lot of various theories on why it didn't work as well. One of them was that they created a lot of exemptions within it, and that created a lot of distortions. So, but here's kind of a summary of what we think are the strengths and weaknesses in a very general sense, and kind of where this has led us to in terms of our simulations is the Ohio-style gross receipts approach with a low rate and broad base, and to see how, with a destination-based tax, to see how that might interact with some of your other tax policy choices. The last area we looked at was called for in the bill was business taxation. Now, first thing I have to point out, and my advisors will real emphasize this, is that businesses don't pay tax. We talk about this a lot, but in final incidence theory, it's not businesses, but really the factors of production, owners of capital, owners of labor, owners of resources, or consumers who pay taxes. So that's what we try to get to in terms of our tax incidence model. But, of course, the issue of business taxes is a big one for you as a policymaker, and there is a lot of always looking at, well, what is the business tax burden, because that potentially affects location and competition. So what I put here is in fact, as I was writing this, the Council of State Taxation released their 2015 numbers here, and here's they are. And I think this report is instructive because it really does show you the broad array of taxes that businesses pay. Sometimes that's shortened to corporate income or something. But the biggest tax the business pays are property taxes, because they're paying taxes on their capital and the land that they use. So and Oregon's about the same as the U.S. average. Of course, where we differ is on the sales tax. And see, that's the number two business tax paid by businesses. And this is business-to-business purchases. So you get, even though it's called a retail sales tax, in practice, most states, about 25 to 30% of their base is business to business. So if you look at the percentages and the cost study, Oregon, we raise about 37.6% of our taxes from these business type taxes. And the average state's 45%. So we are less reliant. And of course, the reason being the absence of a sales tax, one of the big reasons.
Excuse me, just a moment. Senator Boquist.
Just a point of clarification. Could you restate, not the 37%, but you said business to business, what percentage of business expenses business to business?
The percentage of the retail sales tax base, you know, retail being a misnomer, for the typical state, and this is national averages, would be 25 to 30% would be business to business.
Okay.
So that's where that, you know, and that's where the cost goes through and makes those estimates on what businesses are paying in each state through the sales tax.
So follow up, going back to the pyramiding question, is that sort of the same thing? About 25% to 30% would be pyramiding?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, yes, that would be. And that's one of the biggest criticisms you hear from economists about the retail sales tax is that this is a distorting effect of the way the sales tax operates in the U.S.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So you also notice that we do, and I think COST has improved their estimates on this over the years, do go through and include the pass-through entities. And you can see we're about double the national average on pass-through because of our high income tax and reliance on the income tax. So that filters through and does affect it, but obviously doesn't offset the absence of a sales tax. So if you look at kind of what the options are in terms of business taxes and kind of how they fit into this, it's interesting that the way that cost looks at those kind of consumption taxes, non-traditional consumption taxes, such as the BET in New Hampshire, the B&O in Washington, and the CAT, they put those all under corporate income. So all three of those show up under corporate income in the cost analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas they're really consumption taxes, they're not income taxes. So, but that's how, let's say that Oregon was to reduce its income tax and institute a CAT, it would show up in that income tax component in the cost system.
Oh, sorry. Yes, Senator Harris?
Yes, Paul, on that table, why is there such a disparity in Oregon on the unemployment insurance?
Bingo, my question too.
The unemployment tax insurance trust fund, and we've worked on around this issue. Can't remember the last time I had a proposal to look at the table, but we have an automatic stabilizer adjustment table that the rates are dependent on where we are, where the fund balance is, and what have been our worst experiences. So it doesn't require you, that's in statute. So it doesn't require you to come in and raise the rate, for example. Under current statute, if you meet the conditions, if the fund drops to a certain level or if the unemployment rate's at a certain level, then it automatically goes up. The result of that, and this was set up after the experience in the early 80s, so the result of that has been, on the positive side, a relatively healthy unemployment trust fund. We haven't had the problems a lot of other states have had. The downside is it's a higher cost for business, and it does show up in this kind of comparison.
Does this, on the same topic, does this reflect the fact that some other states at least, are seriously underwater? They borrowed money from the federal government and have to pay it back. This table doesn't reflect that, does it?
Mr. Chair, it doesn't directly. It would reflect that if these states undertaxed for their insurance fund and got themselves into trouble. They would be part of the 7.1%. And maybe if there was a higher percentage nationally, we would have less problems. But this is a particular year, so it wouldn't reflect the current state of those funds.
Thank you.
It's a flow into the fund.
It did occur to me that one of the issues is that Oregon has figured out a way to make sure that fund always has money in it to pay for unemployment, and some other states have not.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. As I said, we've had, relative to other states, a relatively healthy unemployment plan.
I think it was Senator Edwards. Or no, it was Boquist?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Could you just comment, Paul, if you would, please, on the other two items on that chart that are roughly 50% higher, and that's personal income tax on pass-through entities and licenses and other taxes. I see, compared to the national average, we're about 50% higher, which is about the same as the unemployment.
Well, there's two things to keep in mind about these percentages. Our percentages are of a lower total because we're less dependent on business taxes. So all our percentages would be a little higher because we don't have the sales tax. So you make up for it with higher in those other areas. But as I mentioned, with the pass-through entities, it reflects our dependence on the personal income tax. Mm-hmm. So we are the most dependent on the personal income tax, so it makes sense that our pass-through entities would be contributing more than businesses in other states. The licenses and other taxes, I think a part of that has to do with the weight mile tax, which is a component of that. But there may be other factors, too, but that's the one I can think of is the weight mile
tax.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair.
I'm wondering, thank you for the question. I think it's a great question. I'm wondering if some of it doesn't have to do with the fact that after Measure 5 passed, the legislature was out looking for money and raised fees for almost everything in order to cover some of those things. And that's a local issue, not a nationwide issue. Is that possible that I'm onto
Mr.
something?
Mr. Chair, that's certainly something we have observed over time, not with this report, but with the census data, which, remember, has those category called charges, which includes things like tuition, which has been a big shift between the general fund and a charge or a fee payment. And you do see that trend clearly was our reliance on charges increased sharply after Measure 5 passed.
Well, does this category include those kinds of things?
This category includes some of those, yes. But, again, it's business only. So
the one that I think of all the time is the farmer who wants to dredge gravel in the river used to have half of the cost of the inspections and so forth paid out of the general fund, and now he has to pay all of it through a fee paid to somebody. That's the sort of thing I was thinking about. The other thing would be things like building permits, mm-hmm. where entire costs of building permits are covered now by the guy who wants to build. Mm-hmm. Used to be that part of that came out of general funds from counties or cities or other places, and that money just simply isn't available anymore in Oregon.
Yes, and I certainly agree with you. We've observed that phenomenon, but this this base is state and local taxes.
It's just state and local.
So okay. They try to control two state and local, quote, taxes. So they don't include fees in this formally. So they're trying to match back to the census calculation on those state and local taxes. So I think they don't include those that are direct fee for service.
Okay, thank you. Senator Boquist?
Okay, so let me just...
We're on the same topic, I think.
Exactly. So yeah. So license and other taxes in this chart, the 50%, as you pointed out, may include the gas tax, and which I agree, pull that out. But having said that, if you pull... We consider the gas tax as part of our other funds budget, but if you pull the other funds budget and you pull that half a billion out... That's chump change, actually, because our other funds budget is almost twice the general fund dollar. And that's not calculated in this matrix here at all. Am I correct?
Again, Senator Boquist, these are taxes. So the definition of taxes is broader than general fund. I mean, it includes, as you say, the highway fund and other kinds of taxes like the provider tax, for example, mm-hmm. is included in the census data as a tax, the healthcare provider tax. But it does not include, obviously, things like federal funds. It doesn't include, you know, if you look at other fund revenue, it includes earnings from the PERS fund. I mean, it's very broad. So it includes a lot of non-tax elements. So this is only the tax part.
Well, Mr.
Yes,
Chair,
please, yeah.
And I'm looking for it. So just for clarity's sake, if we went to LFO's, you know, little chart they always put out with the pie chart, that slice of other funds, which is about a third of the budget, is about 70% larger than general fund combined. That's not in here. Those are fee for services. So that, I don't know, 30 billion, I think it's $35 billion. Is there a budget here? About $35 billion this biennium is other funds And if you just pull out the billion or so for tax for fuel weight mile in there, the rest of it's all fee for service, but it's not calculated in this matrix.
It's not calculated in this matrix, Senator, but what is calculated in this matrix is local taxes. So sure. The property tax is okay. The big factor right. There. So it includes local taxes as well as state.
Okay. So you're really talking about all of the taxes that are levied in the state.
Yes.
State and local, county, cities, fire districts, everything.
Right. And taking that total amount and then using the – actually, it's Ernst & Young that does this study. They go through and they estimate what proportion of those are paid by business directly. So I should put that report out. For you on all
that would be fantastic, okay. And maybe you can include the link to that report along with the other link I asked
sure.
for
mm-hmm.
a little bit ago. Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you for all this. This is really helpful to me. I have a question about, we were talking about the pass-through tax on entities and then corporate income tax, and I'm hoping you can help me understand a principle. My understanding is that C corporations are sort of the income on those is essentially taxed twice because C corps pay corporate tax, and then the income to the shareholders is taxed at the personal income tax rate, and that S corps and LLCs have their income taxed at the personal tax rate to the owners. So, if you had hypothetically, if you can speak to this, it would help me. If you had hypothetically two entities, one is a C corp and it's owned by 10 people in equal measure, and the other is the same size, same annual revenue, LLC, owned by 10 people in equal share. Under the law as it currently stands, am I right that the C Corp would actually pay, that the revenue from this entity, the C Corp ends up paying more as it is because it pays twice, or that revenue is taxed twice as opposed to this one over here, or am I missing something?
Representative Leininger, I think in general that's right. I mean, the issue around double taxation has long been discussed, and that's, of course, it shows up as when you pay out those dividends, it shows up on the personal income tax return, and it's after you've already paid your corporate income tax on them initially. So there is that double tax element, and that has all kinds of implications around how you debt finance versus interest versus borrowing and so forth to finance your corporation. But I think the complicating factor at the state level is, you know, where do these people reside? So, I mean, we're trying to get Oregon taxes. So if you impose a income tax on Intel, where's that initial incidence going to be? Well, our models, most of it is by non-residents because they're stockholders, basically. So they're the owners of capital. So we impose this tax, it falls on the owners of capital, but most of them, a lot of them are non-residents. That's where we get some of the distinctions right. in our analysis.
And there are more wrinkles, of course. Please, go ahead.
So it sounds like, and I definitely understand that that's an issue, it sounds like if the scenario were one in which they were both owned in equal shares by people who all lived in this state, mm-hmm. then there might be a higher aggregate tax rate on the C Corp side, but as the world is complex and varied, it's not the case that that's always how it is. And I think I'm hearing Chair Barnhart over here note that there are also other variations on the way the world can work, which is certainly true.
What occurred to me is that if all 10 of these people are employees of the corporation, their wages are taxed, are deductible to the corporation. If they're partners in the LLC, then their share of the profits of the LLC are taxed personally, and so the effective result is the same in either case, assuming that all of the income is paid out from the C Corp in wages. It gets really complicated really fast, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have business planners who figure out, should I be organized as a C Corp, as an LLC, or some other weird system?
But I will say that we have seen, and we continue to see this, long-term trend nationally of shifting out of the C-corp status toward the other entities, particularly S-corps. And so that, you know, there's a variety of reasons for that. They're not all taxes, but taxes could well be one of them. Okay, so that's the business part. And then we did just look at some options around the income tax, or emphasis around the income tax, because of the diversification argument was largely around what options were there to be to provide tax relief at the income tax side. We looked at marginal rate reductions from our four rate structure with the 5, 7, 9, and 9.9 rates. Another approach is to look at the widening the tax brackets. We've seen there was an article in the Oregonian about this. You've seen some discussion around the fact that our 5% and 7% brackets are really bunched. The 5% bracket is the first $3,350 for a single taxpayer, and then you go to the 7%. So it's a very condensed bracket. So one option would be to widen those brackets. And that would benefit all taxpayers because everybody pays those brackets, but you disproportionately benefit those that have more of their income in those brackets. Another one we've looked at was to expand the standard deduction. The standard deduction is a way to create a zero bracket amount, but it doesn't benefit the high end because they itemize. So it's a way to target tax relief toward, particularly toward middle income. Another way to target tax relief toward middle income is through the use of the exemption credit. And remember, the changes that you made to this in the special session in 13 was to disallow exemption credits for single filers above 100,000, joint filers above 200. So it just goes away. So it's about 190 bucks now. And so you don't get those credits once you exceed the income threshold. So any increase in those credits, for example, doubling those credits, would go to lower and primarily middle income, particularly those that have a lot of exemptions running around the house, and they would be the biggest beneficiaries. The other widely used credit that we have often looked at in our scenarios is the ITC, and you know, we're up to the point now over 10% of taxpayers use the ITC, so it's a pretty broad group out there that use it. So those are some of the things we looked at. Our next section of the report talks about our analytical tools, and I won't go into that. I would call out one thing at the sentence here in this middle paragraph. What OTIM, what the Oregon Tax Incidence Model does, is it compares one point in time. It's not technically a dynamic analysis. It's a comparative static analysis. It compares one point in time. The current situation, what we've estimated, we've updated all our data for the current situation, with a new point in time after the economy has responded to the change in tax policy. So it's gone through our wages and prices, migration has changed, employment has changed, income has changed, income's been redistributed among households, and then we look at that snapshot compared to where we started. So we assume that for tax policy, that's about a five-year period. Now, that's variable. I mean, if the economy is a deep recession, Mark and Josh were talking about how people weren't moving in the Great Recession because they couldn't afford, you know, to move. They were immobile. Well, businesses don't invest in recession. So all of those things take longer, depending on where in the business cycle. But 5 years is, I think, probably a reasonable rule of thumb. So we're not looking at an immediate change. And this is one of the things that I think has created some problems for some states have looked at this dynamic analysis, said, oh, this is going to give us some offsetting revenue. They assume it in their next budget year, and it doesn't show up because it's too short of a time. But even if it is going to eventually show up, it's too short of a time. Kansas is the state that comes to mind. So, and then I've given a little bit more history on the OTIM and kind of the updating we've done, and so that's for your reading. The other thing that we have done is because we have because OTIM is not a forecasting model, it's not a business cycle model, we tried to do some sensitivity analysis on how the mix of taxes affects stability over the business cycle and volatility. And so I'll show you those results. Okay, what I'd like to do is page down to your Appendix B. And the report and look at some of our simulations. And these are, we have three simulations that look at a revenue neutral proposal, and then we have three simulations that raise $500 million a year, or a billion a biennium. So just to give you examples, of course, we can do any simulations you like to see. The first one has a commercial activity tax of 0.45%, and the reason why we have these kind of weird percentages is to try to fit it so it's revenue neutral and a static impact. We increased the standard deduction. I think we've looked at this one earlier. And we also repealed the corporate income tax. So basically what we've done in this simulation, this is on page 19, by the way, in your report. What we've done is reformed your business tax. This is a classic business tax reform. We did what Ohio did. We eliminated the corporate income tax, and we put it in place a cap.
Thank you.
So if you look at this simulation, you can see that, again, this was supposed to be revenue neutral. The cap, by the way, as we would put it in place, the cap would raise about $1.1 billion per year at that level. The corporate is about over $500 million per year. So the income tax, so it's roughly split half between personal income tax and corporate income tax. You can see that the results here are that we have a positive increase in employment. And again, this is something we've consistently had. When we substitute a consumption tax for a income tax, we tend to get positive economic feedback. It's not huge, but you get positive feedback. Employment goes up by about
Representative Benz.
And the reason for that is the standard reason given, consumption tax, income tax, a production tax, thus you have less burden on production. Is that the concept?
Vice Chair Benz, yes. The way that regional economies work is that they're really capacity measures, and your capacity is determined by your labor and capital. And income taxes repel labor and capital more than consumption taxes do. So if we make that switch, we're able to increase our resources. We get in-migration, in other words, and we get additional investment. So if you look at the table there, you can see our investment is up in this scenario by about $90 million, or about 0.6%. And that's the result of eliminating the corporate income tax primarily.
The follow-up. This has been mentioned to me on numerous occasions by various owners of larger businesses in the state that they have an incredibly difficult time attracting mid-management folk to Oregon because of our high income tax. Is that the proof of the point that we would be able to attract more people of that nature if we had a lower income tax and in the alternative a consumption tax? I just want to mean
the income tax works in two ways, and you can see it here. That's right. We do get in-migration, but we also get a more intense use of our existing labor force, and that shows up. If you look at the wage index, notice that wages are down. They're down 1% from our index goes from 100 to 99, so they're down 1% in this scenario. That's because of the income tax. Our labor force employment equations, labor supply equations, are determined not by wages, but by wages minus taxes. So by take-home pay. So that's how it works. So there's a coefficient there in that labor supply function that shows how much people respond to additional take-home pay. And that's captured there. So businesses, they're getting a lower labor costs, and workers are getting higher take-home pay. So that's where you get this higher equilibrium employment. So you get people coming into the state. If you look here, population is up by about 21,000. Employment's up 28,000. So you get a more intense use of your labor force, plus new folks coming in. That also leads to a positive dynamic effect of about $79 million. So we would say after 5 years.
So is the thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the reverse true? So if we raise the income tax, we get just the opposite of this?
If you raise the income tax, it depends on how you raise it. I mean, you get more of a response if you increase the brackets, the higher rate, because there's more mobility for higher rate individuals in our equations. And we've got a scenario that does that, and you can see how that affects things.
Thank you.
So, but the other thing I wanted to point out here, you get a dynamic effect, and you can look at, through the OTIM scenarios, who's affected by income group. And this particular proposal, you can see there's a net gain in household income, but the biggest by far comes in that 34 to 48 group. And they are benefiting from that standard deduction. Because they're getting, a lot of them are getting zeroed out on their income taxes. The low group doesn't benefit hardly at all from the standard deduction because they don't pay much taxes or very little. So they're already zeroed out, in effect. But they do pay some CAT through higher prices. And the high end, you can see, does lose because they pay CAT, and this is where we get the CAT coming through the, through we think through the pass-through income showing up here, and they don't get any benefit from the income tax reduction. And most of the corporate income tax reduction leads to more investment, but not necessarily to more household income, because you have a lot of out-of-state residents that are that corporate ownership. So that's the scenario one. Scenario two looks at a reduction in marginal rates, looks at 0.5% commercial activity tax, and we get a somewhat smaller effect, employment gains, population gains, some investment gains, but they're smaller, so we get a bigger effect. I'm a little surprised at this, where we get a bigger effect from that standard deduction than we did from lowering the marginal rates.
Back up just a second. I think what you just said is simulation one works differently than simulation two.
Yes,
simulation. Is that what you just said, or did I misunderstand
that? Yes, simulation two cuts the personal income tax rates.
Right.
So 4, 6, 8, 2, and 9, 2. Simulation one expands the standard deduction.
Right, and the sentence that you said just before I asked my question, I think refers to that, doesn't it? Or did
yes.
I misunderstand
I'm
that?
Saying that we get a bigger economic feedback from the standard deduction increase than we do from the marginal rates.
Thank you. Okay. Now
I'm a little surprised by that, but we do. Yeah.
This is dense stuff, and it takes a while to keep up with it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, and then again, you can see how the household incomes are affected. Primarily, you get the benefits going to the middle income. There's some losses at the high end. And again, we think this some of this is due to the CAT filtering through on the pass-through income. Our third scenario looks at, it's a much more direct one. We looked at a 20.25% CAT and a $50,000 homestead exemption. And again, you get similar employment effects and population effects, a little bit less, a bigger dynamic revenue impact because you're picking up feedback from additional home ownership, additional residential construction resulting from the homestead exemption. And you do particularly, you can see benefit that low income group. In fact, you benefit all income groups under this proposal with the exception of the those above 205,000, and they have a relatively small loss of 0.2%. So this is this proposal, while it has a little bit smaller overall effects than the scenario one, it's more evenly distributed across the income groups. So those are the kind of trade-offs that you can look at through these simulations. And if I could just run through our revenue increase ones real quickly, I'm running out of time. This is designed to generate a $500,000 increase. So we have a bigger CAT, a 0.65 CAT. And we widen the brackets. So this is what we talked about earlier. We're widening these brackets to 5 to 7%. And that's going to hit everybody, but primarily middle income, proportionally more. And then we repeal the corporate income tax. You can see that employment gains are about 25,000. There's a net loss in personal income because this is a revenue raiser. But in spite of the fact, and we always think this is significant, this is showing that by shifting to a consumption base and away from an income base, then you can actually have and still raise revenue, you can actually have a positive dynamic effect. So typically you think of increases in taxes having a negative dynamic effect, but what the model's telling us that, first of all, these effects are not big, but they're in the right sign, right direction, if you strategically combine your components.
Oh, sorry, Senator Hass.
Thank you. Paul, on this scenario, that's $500 million for a year?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's $500 per year. So these are set to 2017 levels.
Right. So you're raising $500 million a year. You're offering people a tax cut on their personal income taxes. And with this commercial activities tax, you're also putting forward a modest, I would say, more than modest boost in the economy. Is that true?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. The 0.65, though, keep in mind that would be a significant increase, considerably higher than Ohio's.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm. So, and again, you can see the distribution here. You get an increase in activity, but household income is lower because, you know, you've got, you're collecting more in taxes. And household income is gross income minus tax. So now, the dynamic effects offset a lot of that, but not all of it.
Now, just let me follow up on Chair Hass's question. This commercial activities tax would have an effect on out-of-state stockholders of multi-state corporations that did business in Oregon, would it, or wouldn't it? Because their profits might be net profits might be lower because of this tax.
Mr. Chair, it would, but this is a much broader base. So it affects all the sales in Oregon. So
yes.
So the amount of out-of-state taxes paid is, the proportion is much less under BAT or CAT than it is under the corporate, the corporate excise tax that operates now.
Does
so the percentage that's exported is much less than under the corporate.
Does that show up on this table somehow? It doesn't.
We have that calculation.
Could we get that information as a sort of an add-on to these simulations as to what the leakage is?
Chair, we look at the, we have an export, initial export. The other thing, by the way, that, you know, when we look at the tax burden, that this doesn't include is the taxes we pay to other states. So, in other words, that are exported to us. So, it's not the total tax burden because it's only the Oregon portion of the tax burden.
Right. Maybe you could do another little report on that issue.
The Tax Foundation actually does an estimate, and it does show that Oregon is a tax importer. So we import taxes from other states.
Meaning we pay more than our share.
Yes, primarily because of the severance taxes, the oil and gas taxes that we pay based on our consumption, coming from Alaska and.
Senator Edwards will want to know about that issue.
Okay. The second simulation, members of the committee, you can see does have a very small positive dynamic revenue impact of $4 million, but it does result in a decrease in employment and population and investment. So it does have some, these are very small numbers, but it does have a negative compared to the simulation one, which had a positive effect on employment and population investment. This is where we get a higher marginal tax rate in response to Representative Bence's question. Here we're imposing, instead of a 9 and a 9.9, we've got a 9.7 and a 12. So what that does is have some reduction in investment, some reduction in employment, and you can see in terms of the distribution, it particularly hits the high income because we lose, under this scenario, we lose 443 million household income. Over three-fourths of that is from the 205 plus group. So this is really, the tax burden is really heavily on the high-income group.
The effect is small, but I don't understand how it would have an effect on the middle-income groups negatively, but apparently it does.
Mr. Chair, it picks up secondary effects through economic activity, through investment in particular.
I got you.
But they also, keep in mind, of course, it doesn't take long to get to that 9% rate. So we're keeping the brackets the same under this proposal. Instead of going from 7 to 9, you go from 7 to 9.7.
Ah, gotcha.
So you get at a low income level.
Well, in fact, people in those brackets will pay some of those taxes directly.
Yes. And then the last scenario is, again, has some almost no employment population effects, even though you raise $500 million. And again, it's the combination of, that you put together. This is a 0.3 commercial activity tax, EITC of 24% of the federal going from 8 to 24, and $100,000 homestead exemption. So it has a lot of elements to it. And you can see it's particularly beneficial at the low end. And we tried to, under this scenario, try to really benefit the low-income groups. And we can do this through the EITC and through the homestead exemption. So you get a pretty powerful combination. But, of course, you're raising revenue, so you're really increasing the progressivity of the tax system under this proposal because you're expanding EITC, doing a homestead exemption, and then you're also imposing a BAT, which is, or a CAT, which is more broadly distributed across those income groups. So this is the way, you know, the question about how do you offset the rate regressivity of a consumption tax? Well, here's the way you do it. There's two tools, homestead exemption, EITC.
Dr. Warner, that homestead exemption, though, wouldn't that hit the local government pretty hard?
If I could go to my last policy implications, Senator, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And you know, if you look at my fourth point here on my conclusions is, we believe these simulations of the report provide important insights. One of the things it does not talk about is, under B, their report glosses over important governance and administration issues. One of them, obviously, is governance. So if you start changing the property tax, you're affecting all those tax districts out there. Now, you know, there's a way to address that. You could try to broaden the property tax base by going more to market value. But as we've said, there's some real obstacles to that. If you're going to fund it with a CAT or something that was a statewide tax, what you would do is you'd have to set up a transfer mechanism to the local taxing districts to compensate them for the homestead exemption. Now, you know, we do that with the homestead, with the property tax deferral, for example. Department of Revenue just pays the property tax. So you could set up something like that.
And we did it with the HARP, too, didn't we?
We did it, yes. State has been in the property tax relief business for a long time.
Yeah, please.
What I'm getting out of that, though, is it's like, what's the point? If we're going to take away from local government and then we just take the money and give it back to local government to keep them off, I mean, what's the point?
Well, there's still a net $500 million increase in total revenue, isn't there?
But we might have to just give that back to keep local governments going.
Well, but even after you give them back the money, we'd still have more, wouldn't we? Or is this is this net for the whole system or net just to the state?
Yes, this is net for the whole system.
For the whole system.
Yes, so you would still have more revenue. But you would also, you know, there are instances when it may be more efficient to collect revenue at a higher level and spend it at a lower level. And that's why we have various kinds of revenue sharing programs. I mean, we, for example, OLCC, we send almost half of our OLCC revenue to cities and counties. So, you know, that's one way of doing that.
I think it'd be a tough sell in my district.
Yeah. Well, in the case you just mentioned, it's very efficient to collect the money that way.
Yes.
But the effects of OLCC sales are felt on local jurisdictions, and so we distribute funds to those jurisdictions to cover those effects.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Chair, if I could just go to my conclusions and then whatever.
I thought an hour and a half was going to be way plenty, and obviously we have so many questions that we may have to discuss this some more.
I know people have thought about this, and that's why it was hard to kind of consolidate this into a single report without turning it into War and Peace.
We're going to get to War and Peace.
That's volume two. So, but here's the general policy inclusions. I don't think there's anything surprising, because I know you've all thought about this issue. And I think that it's pretty clear the tax system could be restructured by the legislature. You could work out a plan that our models would show would lead to broad economic gains in terms of household income, employment, and investment. And you could do this certainly with a revenue-neutral package, and if you strategically combine those, you could do it with revenue-raising packages. Now, there's a limit to that, but it could be done according to our modeling, keeping in mind those other things that you've got to remember besides just the economic modeling. The second thing is, because of the mix of taxes, I really didn't talk too much about stability, but if you looked at our stability measures, you get a lot higher standard deviation for the personal income tax than you do for consumption taxes. So Oregon's mix leads to more instability. Again, not a surprise. If you change that mix, you're going to get less instability, less volatility, but slower long-term growth. There's a trade-off between the two. The more stable the system, generally the slower it grows over time. The more unstable, generally the faster it grows. And that's also related to what the state economist said today about progressivity and volatility. Those are all tied together. The third point is the tax burden distribution. And this is one of the things that I think you probably should look at and talk about at a later time. But here's our new distribution from all the taxes, and we looked at how the individuals, and that's how you can see those effective tax rates differ across the income groups. And this is the result of our updating of the OTIM model. Here's where we have a 9.29% rate showing up for the low-income households. Look, these household numbers are not the same, so we divvied them up for income categories. And you can see you get this kind of, we had this result earlier back when we initially did OTIM, you get kind of a bowl-shaped effect where you have a higher rate at the bottom end, a higher rate at the top end, but in the middle it's pretty much constant. So it's a proportional system. Mm-hmm. And that's in contrast to the federal system, which is highly progressive because of the way their income tax is structured. But most state and local systems are regressive. Mm-hmm. So if you become more like other state and local tax systems, you're likely to reduce some of the progressivity unless you're very careful about how you do it. I think there's ways you can do it, but it would take some mixing and matching. So you can see that the overall household taxes pay about 8.9% of their household income in state and local taxes, and the top 205,000 pay about 9.6%. That rate has gone up from what we had before because of the policies you've enacted. That the 9.9% rate, phase out of the federal tax subtraction, and disallowance of the personal exemption credit. All those things feed into that and have caused that to bump up at that high income group. So it is clear if you want to help that less than 20,000 group, you've got tools to do that. And you have other tools to affect the distribution in the way that if you think changes need to be made. There's no perfect distribution of the tax burden. That's up to you as policymakers. And it varies by state, varies by country, varies over time. So, but I think it's helpful to at least get a sense of where we are now. And this is our best shot at where we are under the current system.
Heavy reading. Are there some things that people would like added to this report that might be useful in reading it, Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How about the 800-pound gorilla in the room here? I asked last time we met, and I was hopeful that we were going to see it this time. We have IP28 that's out there, which is a 2.25% minimum tax, which is really a cat to the top people, which is what we're really kind of comparing things against here. And then we also have IP27 and IP26, which both are variants in theirs. The question I think we're all looking at here, and let's the 800-pound gorilla again here, is discussion about what's going to happen in the February session, if anything, is we haven't seen a model of IP28, which is our Oregon proposal. Obviously, we can model it because we have the commercial activities tax here. We just changed the name and a few things. It's really what it is. and then IP 27 and IP 26, which are increases in the two different versions of increases in the upper income tax brackets. And if we could model those in OTEM, this is the third time I've asked this, by the way, gentlemen, is then we would have something to compare and look at. So, and it would also be provide some independent knowledge to the public of what is the real impact of, or what do we think the impact is of IP 28, because all of these matrices and simulations we're doing here, I mean, let's face reality, if IP 28 passes, we would be changing it, or we would be saying we should do this instead of IP 28, 27, or 26 in theory. So we're missing half of the equation for comparison in the future, and since it's all three of these have been approved to the point of where they're getting signatures, and for those of us that are campaigners, which I think is everybody at the diocese here, I don't think anybody is under the illusion that they can't be put on the ballot. They will be on the ballot in one form or the other. So we really need to have that information, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair, to make rational decisions in the next few weeks, because weeks is it. If we do anything, we're going to the February session and do something. If not, we're going to see or watch IP 28, 26, and 27 become law by the voters.
Sorry to ask.
Thank you. I want to thank our legislative revenue officer and his staff for an excellent analysis. This was part of state law that we passed in the last session, and I was lucky I was able to order early, and I had a copy available to me the last couple of days, and I've been going through it, and a lot of the facts and analysis, which are so rich and detailed, are not in any previous documents, and I think there's a lot of tools and help and analysis for us as we move forward and look into some of this tax reform discussion. But I would implore everybody in the committee and legislators and, frankly, anyone within earshot to go get a copy of this and read it, because of a lot of what's in here will be very helpful as we move forward and look at some of these ballot measures, none of which were even out of the gates when we first passed this law. So I just wanted to say thank you. This is a marvelous document, and you guys did a great job. And to everyone who participated, thank you.
These are very competitively priced.
It's on your website, isn't it?
Yeah.
Under publications?
Well, we will be shortly. Yes.
We will be shortly. Representative Bence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, I want to thank you for the work. It's great. I want to join Senator Boquist in asking for that type of analysis. I think it would be crazy for us to go into the session without knowing the consequences of what appears is going to be on the ballot. It would be something we should be doing, and I hope that you can do it.
If I could just say something on that, Mr. Chair. And of course, we have had discussions and got a lot of questions about IP 28 in particular. But I do want to point out that it is not a straight pushing a button in OTIM, because our CAD in OTIM covers everything. So I mean, we don't go through and pick out the sectors paying different rates. Under IP 28. You've got only C corps paying, and you've got them paying the tax, marginal tax, only on gross sale organ sales above $25 million. So we'll have to go through sector by sector to determine what is the effective initial rate on each of those sectors based on the degree of concentration in that sector and based on the proportion of sales we think are accounted for by C corps. So that's, we have to piece through that. We have some kind of macro aggregate level data that will help us do that, but we're going to have to go through and over the Department of Revenue use our statutory authority to look at individual returns, and of course we're subject to the same disclosure laws as they are in DOR, and try to see what makes the most sense in terms of assumptions. So we do have quite a bit of work to really make a decent estimate on IP 28, and we'd much rather do that rather than throw something together that we're not confident in and we have to end up changing at a later time. So right. That's kind of, it isn't, you know, it isn't a reticence on our part because just we don't want to do it. It's because we want to make sure we do it right.
What is the requirement for a measure that actually makes the ballot and your office's involvement in reporting or whatever?
Our office has a statutory role in response to the Financial Impact Committee. The Financial PAC committee has ex officio members, Secretary of State, the Treasurer, the Director of DAS, and the Director of Department of Revenue. And they can request that we provide analysis of potential secondary effects. And, of course, if they do that, and presumably they will, and they've already talked to us about it, we would use OTIM to make an analysis for those secondary effects.
But you'd have all the complexities that you were just describing before I asked that question.
Yes.
Wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yes, yeah. We would, Mr. Chair. And I'm just saying that we can't just impose this as an across-the-board 2.5% tax. We've got to go through sector by sector within OTIM. It's, you know, I mean, it's always a truism about models. I mean, if it's the input part is the work, and if you input garbage, you're going to get you know what out the other
end.
You
want so many numbers that you can actually have some predictive value.
Yeah, that we can defend and have, you know, some rational basis to it.
Before I ask Representative Benz to go ahead and ask his next question, let me simply add to Chair Haas's comments that we much appreciate the work on these kinds of studies. They help us to think about what, if anything, we might want to do differently than we're doing now. Very much appreciated.
Thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it wasn't so much a question as it was a comment. I have lost track, literally, of the number of times different folks up here have said something about the unforeseen consequences of measure, fill in the blank, 55, even name it. And so any help you can give us in anticipation of the consequences of these that we see coming would be welcome.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, understood.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Exceptional work on the simulations. Ditto what both the chair said. And when you're going through IP28 and the consequences of that, I think several questions came up from bipartisan members here across the deal here. Is it because you're going to have to look at this 100 group of 100, so on and so forth. But in looking at it, I think you also should be able to make the determination of sort of breakout of pyramiding, of which of these are pyramid-type industries, which of these might be PUCU industries, which of these are regulated entities in which, you know, that pass-through, which will then, you know, go on to the consumer, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a $5 billion question, which is 10 times larger than any revenue forecast in this document. And the criticalness of that, and even the impact of 26 and 27, which are more straightforward. They're just tax increases of the bracketing, which you've already modeled here.
Yes.
But, I mean, to decide whether we're going to do, as the chair of the House Revenue Committee says, what we're going to do, if anything, we really need to have that comparison very quickly. Other than that, we're going to do nothing, and we're going to see a 10-time increase that many people in this building are going to cringe at, whether you support it or don't support it, because of the financial implications across the budgeting spectrum, meaning it ain't all going to go where they think it's going to go to when it passes.
Thank you. And with that, we're only 5 minutes over what I thought we were going to be. Thank you so much for today, and we appreciate it very much. Anything else from you? All right. The House Committee on Revenue is adjourned.
We are adjourned.
So which of these?
We are adjourned.